Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Long and Winding Royal Road. This is episode 4, and my name is W.H. Park. Of course, I'm the co-host of the Post Perez monthly show with John Pollock here at postwrestling.com. And I might have said before on a previous episode of The Long and Winding Royal Road that every fourth episode of this series will cover a particular person from the roster of All Japan Pro Wrestling from the 90s. I picked the fourth episode because, you know, like the main eventers of the time were called the Four Pillars of Heaven. And so we're going to do every fourth episode. So episode 4, episode 8, 12, 16, and so forth and so on. And to kick things off with these profile episodes, who better than to talk about Mitsuhara Misawa and of course, the ace of All Japan Pro Wrestling of the 90s. And who better to help me talk about Mitsuhara Misawa than, in my estimation, one of the premier authorities of Misawa and his company that he found after he left All Japan Pro Wrestling, and that's Pro Wrestling Noah, and that's Hisami over at on Twitter. It's at Hisami. It's a very interesting way to spell it. It's at H-I 5-A-M-E. And, of course, she also has a blog that you can find all the information you need about Pro Wrestling Noah. If you want to know, what did they say? What did Kenno yell this time? What did those guys in the Rattel say this time? Well, she'll translate all that stuff for you if you really want to know. I personally don't always necessarily want to know what Kenno has to say or is yelling or what the Rattels have to say. But if I want to know what Katsuhiko Nakajima and Go Shizaki are beefing over these days, I'll go over to her blog. And that's at proprogramtranslations.blogspot.co.uk. And then we'll get Hisami to give us some plugs at the end of the show as well. But Hisami, how are you today?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a nice bright September day. So how have you been?
I'm good. It's still very hot and humid here in Japan. But yeah. I'm hoping typhoon season's around the corner.
I was about to say you've got the rainy season rolling in.
Yeah, yeah. But that always like comes with the promise of like cooler weather, and yeah. And I don't have to keep my air conditioner on all the time to stay comfortable. So yeah, so you are like I said, an authority on Pro Wrestling Noah in the English speaking wrestling fandom, pro res fandom. Like I've discovered you on Twitter. And of course, I listened to a great episode you did with my friend Dylan Fox over at the Eastern Lariat. You did a primer about Pro Wrestling Noah. And I urge people to go check that out, as well as like a primer, a kind of a small, like a shorter version of that kind of a style of a show that John Pollock and I did about Noah a couple of months ago at Post Perez. You can check that out at the feed at postwrestling.com. But my question for you, like to start off this episode is, what got you into professional wrestling and what got you into loving Pro Wrestling Noah so much?
I actually got into pro wrestling when I was a child. I must have been about 9 or 10 years old. And it was actually through WWF, as it was known at the time. My younger brother had some trading cards and he bought them back. And there's even a kind of a picture of that moment of us sitting on a train together and we're looking at them. But I got into wrestling itself that way. Pro Wrestling Noah actually came a few years later when my boyfriend said to me that I might like Japanese wrestling. And he brought home some tapes that he'd you know, in those days it was VHS trading, it was the early 2000s. And one of the tapes was Pro Wrestling Noah. And you had with it All Japan, New Japan, Dragon Gate. But it was just Noah that I loved the most of all of it.
What was it about like Noah itself that attracted you more than the other companies on those tapes?
Yeah, looking back on it, I think it must have been just it was so different from all the others. I mean, New Japan, you know, you had the big production. All Japan, it interested me, but not as much. Noah seemed to be just a lot smaller, a lot more intimate, and I think that's what appealed to me.
So who caught your eye on the Noah roster at that time when you were really getting, like, first starting getting into it?
I think it must have been the junior division. I remember just being just really like just fascinated by them, and I loved the veterans, and I just loved just the way the whole thing was just laid out. I don't remember exactly who it was in particular, but I do remember it must have been just the fast pace of the juniors to begin with, because I've always been fond of the junior division and how you've got the kind of like the big divide in those days before it really started to change. Between the juniors and the heavyweights, but I do remember that.
And then that would expand to, like, you know, by my estimation, like from reading your Twitter and like your other work on your blog, is that you become so knowledgeable about like the entire history of the company and different yes. members of the roster. So, and so that's why, you know, I'm inviting you to do this profile piece on Mitsuhara Misawa, because obviously you know a lot about his life. I've read some of your work about it, and I've learned so many things about Misawa that I didn't know before. I was like, wow, I have to have Hisami on this show to talk about Misawa. But what is it about, before we get into kind of like his life, let me ask you, like, what is it about Misawa that you find captivating?
I find him captivating the fact that he wasn't somebody that, you know, you'd look at and you'd think, oh my gosh, you know, he's got the looks or anything like that. What he had was what Barbara was always looking for. And it was the presence. It was what he could do. He was an inventor. He was inventive. For example, before Misawa, nobody had actually utilized the elbow in the way that he did. The suplex, people had done it, but they didn't, you know, they didn't make it as he did. It was the fact that he was inventive, and, you know, he was also somebody rather than who, you know, be threatened by what was out there, be threatened by change, be threatened by another company. He was actually somebody who saw more in a way of helping them. He was a fascinating person because there were so many different sides of him. That's what really fascinated me, you know, his sad childhood, his love for animals, you know, his, you know, the way that the roster saw him as a father, how he was a businessman. There's a lot of aspects of Misawa which were so interesting, which is what I find.
So your exposure to him and Noah, did that inspire you to like go back and check out his stuff, you know, pre-Noah, which would be, of course, in All Japan Pro Wrestling?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was, again, my boyfriend, because he got me like loads of like discs and later VHS and DVDs of it as well, and I remember looking up some of his Old Japan matches and just reading, you know, some of the most vicious elbows you've ever seen in wrestling. I thought, yeah, that is something I really, really must see. And from then on, I was kind of I'm someone who loves history anyway, so then I was kind of hooked in discovering, you know, the history of, you know, that era of Old Japan, you know, Barber's history. And I'm even, you know, thinking about looking into doing some more on Riki Dozan, because he being the father of Japanese wrestling, I think, you know, his contribution, what he gave, what he did, I think that gets lost as well. But yeah, I thought, you know, I really must know more about Misawa's time in All Japan, because I feel like I'm skipping a chapter otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great story. I mean, for my own self, like, I remember when I first got into, you know, tape trading back in the late 90s, and I got this tape that was like a mix of primarily like New Japan and some it was like New Japan and All Japan and like some Michinoku Pro, but
yeah.
I was like, the first time I like really saw anything from All Japan, and I was like, these guys are wearing like really funky colored tights. Like Misawa had the green and the silver, and Kawada was black and yellow. Kobashi was, you know, orange. Akiyama was blue. Tawei was red. And Misawa kind of like, you know, really sparked my interest when I first saw him. Cause I think he was the most colorful, like with his tights and like the way he wrestled and stuff like that. And I think the first match I ever saw him was a match we'll probably mention, like, as we go through his life and his career, is the match where he debuted the Tiger Driver 91. Like, was that against, that was against Tawei, right?
Yes. Yeah. I believe it was. Yeah.
And I remember vividly seeing that, like, and just jumping off my couch. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, he has killed Akira Tawei. Yeah. But Akira Tawei's still alive. And I'm like, how did he survive that? That's crazy. And then you just get deeper into these matches, and then you, like, you know, you see the matches like Kobashi has with Dr. Dusty Williams, where he's getting backdrop suplex onto his head, and I'm just like, you know,
it's, you just wonder how they just survived, because all Japan in those days, it wasn't just a fight, it was a war. I mean, those guys just rode shotgun. It's just mind blowing what they did.
Oh yeah, I can't believe, like, some of these guys, like, were able to continue, like, another 10, 15 years after this. Obviously, like, it took its toll on all of their bodies. But, you know, beyond that, like, as I continue watching, like, I've become deeply fascinated by this rivalry between Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada, because, like, of all the great matches he's having with Taue, with Stan Hansen, with Kenta Kobashi and Akiyama and all these other people in these various tags, there is a certain intensity that is unmatched when he's in there with Kawada.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was just, I mean, even the ref used to have to get, like, legitimately between them to separate them, to prevent them from killing each other. Because, I mean, Kawada, as we know, he had that notoriously short temper. And Misawa, he used to provoke him. And you always knew when Kawada was about to lose his temper, because there was just, like, this split second where he just used to go just really still, and then he'd snap. And then it was, you know, it was on as it never was before. But the ref used to have to get between them and just sometimes just legitimately separate them, because Misawa used to just poke him too far.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, for me, like, I love all these guys, you know, but for me, my favorite member of the Four Pillars has always been Kawada, just because I find his story a little bit more fascinating than the other three. It's that's quality you're talking about, like, that there's that, you know, that legit intensity that he has in his matches with everyone, especially with Misawa, but just even with Kobashi, and then he's, you know, early on his feud with Akira Taue when they were on opposite sides. He, you know, Taue's in Suriragun and Kawada's still a member of Super Generation Army. But you know, but we're not here to talk about Kawada. We're getting off track already. Sorry about that. We're here to talk about Mitsuhara Misawa, and let's get into it. I'm just gonna start off with saying, like, you know, first of all, we gotta talk about, he was born in Yubari, Hokkaido, but early on, his family moved to a place called Koshigaya in Saitama. That was because I think the coal mine where his father had worked started to decline and close down.
Misawa didn't really have many memories of Hokkaido growing up, because his family had left a few months after he'd been born. But nevertheless, he seemed to have always been very fond of the place, because he'd take Noah up there, and, you know, he used to take, you know, some of the roster to his favorite, his favorite restaurant. And years later, when Marufuji went back, they showed him that, you know, the restaurant was still there, and, you know, Misawa still had his favorite seat. And even touchingly, during their All Japan years, when it was the anniversary of his death, Shiozaki and Kotaro Suzuki, they actually visited Misawa's favorite restaurant, and they laid out a place for him. They put out his favorite drink and his cigarettes. So even though he didn't remember it, Misawa was still fond of Hokkaido.
That's a really great story about, like, Shiozaki and Kotaro Suzuki going to his favorite restaurant. He had a very, like, troubled childhood.
He did. His father was a drunk, and the main targets of, you know, the, say, for example, his violence was his wife and his second son, which is Misawa. It is believed that Misawa actually had an older brother, but his father, for some reason, preferred the older brother to the younger one. And his mother used to get the worst of his father's drunken rage. And so what she used to do is that when things got too bad, she used to keep, like, blankets and, you know, shoes and a change of clothes in bags. And she'd run away to the park with her children.
That's a really harrowing to listen to, yeah.
Yeah, and one point things got so bad that he actually attacked her with a knife. Obviously, you know, after a while they divorced. I think Misawa must have been about 8 years old or so when his father finally vanished from his life, and he never had anything to do with him after that. But there was a time when he was in training and he was actually in tears. And they asked him what was wrong. And he said that I'm just reminded of my mother. Because obviously, you know, everyone's hitting each other, they're fighting each other. But I think when he first started training, he found, you know, this resurrection of the memories of this terrible childhood he'd had, very hard to deal with it at times.
Well, he got into training because, like, I guess one of the things he found solace in was professional wrestling, especially, you know, the All Japan Pro Wrestling. I read that his first favorite wrestler was a man by the name of Horst Hoffmann.
Yes, Horst Hoffmann had been a German wrestler, and he'd been active in Japan, and Misawa was really taken with him, and hence the reason for the green, which he used in Horstmann's honor.
And so, like, he would, and of course he would later incorporate these colors in his own promotion in pro wrestling,
yes.
NOAH. He wanted to start, you know, training as a wrestler he wanted to become a wrestler from the age of 12, and he wanted to go straight into it, but like his mother and some of his teachers said, no, you gotta finish school first. You gotta go into college first.
Yeah, and he was also taught that by Jumba Saruta as well, because when Misawa was part of the wrestling club at high school, he actually went to All Japan. Saruta answered the door and said to him, no, you know, you're going to have to graduate before you come back. But which was different to, let's say, for example, Ogawa's story, because Ogawa was a high school dropout, but Barbara accepted him. But with Misawa, no, he was told, you need to graduate and then, you know, and then come back.
And it's at the Ashikaga Institute of Technology in Tochigi that he would attend high school there on a scholarship, but he would also meet someone very important to him, and that would be one Toshiaki Kawada.
Yeah, Kawada was actually a year younger than Misawa, and he actually joined on Misawa's, you know, invite All Japan a year later. It could have been very different for Kawada because he almost joined New Japan. But no, it was Misawa who said to him to come to All Japan. And they went to all sorts of, you know, places together in their time in high school. They went overseas. But, you know, despite all that, it was actually a very, very tough life being part of the wrestling club, because the only days they ever got off, and we're talking about a whole year here, was New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. That was it. On the rest of the year, they trained nonstop. They only had 2 days off in 365.
Wow, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
But Misawa found some success as a high school wrestler.
He did. It's a case of what he actually won. But I know that he did win some very prestigious awards. I know that he won like a national award or something, and I think he was almost chosen for the Olympics.
So he wrestled at 187 pounds, and he won the National High School Championship in 1980.
That's it, yeah.
And same year, he placed fifth at the Freestyle World Championships, competing in the junior age group. So, like, you know, he was good at it, but apparently he wasn't really a fan of amateur wrestling.
No, part of the reason why he actually got interesting in the first place was because he found that it was, you know, better to do it than to watch it. It was more fun. And also the other reason was that it went back to his father, because if he felt that, you know, if he was big, if he was muscled, then nobody ever again was going to try and attack him.
Yeah, so from high school, he would enter the All Japan Pro Wrestling Dojo in March of 1981, and he was trained mainly by Kazuharu Sonoda and Akihisa Takechiho, also known as, respectively, the Magic Dragon and the Great Kabuki, which I think is really interesting that, like, he was trained by one of his main trainers was the Great Kabuki.
Yes. Yeah.
He would also receive some training from The Destroyer, Dick Baer, Shohei Baba, of course, Dory Funk Jr., and eventually even the legendary Luthez. So he had a really, you know, very solid foundation to work from.
Yeah, Baba wasn't really interested in wrestlers who could only show him how well they could throw a punch or how well they could, you know, let's say, you know, suplex an opponent and whatever. What Baba wanted was wrestlers who could take a move. And he was very particular about it, because until you could actually do this to his satisfaction, and until you actually made, you know, what could best be approximated as the sound, he wouldn't let you debut. It was always said that there's a story that goes that Barber was backstage and he was talking to somebody, and he stopped and he listened to what was going on in the ring, and he said, it's Misawa. Because, you know, there's this very certain sound, this very certain way they took the ropes, this very certain way that they fell. Barber knew who was in the ring. It's kind of a nuance that Tenryu heard, that also that when he went to Noah. But that was the way that, you know, Barber was very strict about, you know, you have to do it this way. You have to do the sound that I want. Otherwise, you know, forget it. I want you to be able to receive, not just take.
So at some point, like, you know, like by August of the same year, like Barber must have been satisfied with the sounds that Misawa was making. Yeah. So he debuted August 21st, 1981 in the match against Shiro Koshinaka. Maybe many people know as the master and inventor of the hip attack. He lost in this match against Koshinaka. It was at an outdoor show in Urawa. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I live in Japan. I sometimes can't pronounce places in Japan. It's a little embarrassing. But that he made his debut. He lost, as most, you know, young boys in professional wrestling in Japan tend to do. They tend to lose, like, not only their first match, Sami. They tend to lose a lot of their matches when they start out.
They do. In a way, it's kind of mirroring geisha. Because geisha, when they're maiko, they start off, and they're, you know, the trainees, they start off by... you know, always attending, let's say, parties with their older, you know, with their older sisters, with the seniors. They start off by watching them. They don't actually do anything by themselves for a while. It's kind of the same in wrestling, in a way, in that the trainees, they will always lose their first match. They will always wait at ringside. You know, they will always have, you know, these matches, tag matches, where usually they are the ones that take the fall. Before they're actually judged to be able to be start branching off by themselves. It's learning by observation, and Misawa's was no different. Although his debut was actually the short, you know, one of the shortest times from, you know, entry to actually, you know, getting in the ring.
Yeah, and he wouldn't have to, like, you know, go for years on years losing anything. He would get his first win on October 9th in a tag match with teaming with Mitsuo Momoda, one of the sons of Riki Dozan, and they were facing the team of Hiromichi Fuyuki, who would later join Tenryu over in SWS and War and move on to FMW. Fuyuki was teaming with Nobuyoshi Sugawara, and they won that tag match. And then Misawa would actually get his first singles match win against Sugawara several nights later.
Yes. Yeah. It's a big moment to watch. It's not... not easy to find, but if you can find clips, I kind of call it the blooming. It's kind of when, you know, Misawa really started to find his feet and perhaps to, you know, to take off. And I think he also then kind of gained an awareness. And I think so did Barber about who he was and where, you know, where he was going and what he was going to become. Because as time, you know, progressed, we'll get to the Barber Misawa story later. It's not really the place for it is now.
Based on your research, did you think, did the fans take the Misawa right away?
They did and they didn't. I think they were interested to see what he'd become. But I also think that they were kind of thought, okay, we know, let's let him get a bit more momentum because there's other guys here, older guys on the roster. And we'll see how it goes. But they were certainly interested in him, especially because, you know, he had the shortest time from debut, you know, from entry to debut. So he was, you know, he was a heating up prospect.
Yeah, and from here we get to April of 1983, and this is kind of like the next phase of Misawa's career. He would enter a tournament called the Luthez Cup.
Yes.
And he would reach the finals, and let's talk about, like, the reward for the winner of the Luthez Cup here.
I think for Misawa, it put him on another level and it put him on the next level that he needed to go. I don't think for him that competing in the tournament would just have been enough. He needed to win it. And I think also by this time, in All Japan, Barber was starting to slow down. And I think he was also becoming aware that he himself was, you know, I think he was starting to feel the first effects of perhaps his illness. And I think behind the scenes in all Japan, it was a time when, you know, Misawa started also to gain prominence. But, you know, for him, winning that cup was something that needed to happen. Otherwise, I don't think things would have turned out the way it would have done.
He would make the finals against Koshinaka, and they would have their match in on April 22nd in the Nakajima Sports Center. And the finals were refereed by Luthez himself, which is pretty cool. And then he lost the match, but, you know, apparently Baba, like, loved what he saw from both, and especially from Misawa. So he said, okay, I'm going to send both these guys, and they're both going to get the prize, which is an excursion to go to Mexico.
Yeah, he went off with, I think, Shiro Koshinaka also joined them. But I do remember that their time in Mexico, it was interesting, but I think it was quite difficult for them both. But Misawa relished in all of that. But then, you know, he was told by Baba, well, you have to come home because I want to make you Tiger Mask. And Misawa thought, well, I don't want to be Tiger Mask. I don't want to come home. Because contrary to, you know, what was always thought, Misawa did not like being Tiger Mask at all.
No, that's definitely, like, something you kind of, I feel watching him as Tiger Mask, like, I feel like I can see his discomfort being that character. But I do have to make one note, like, Misawa and Koshinaka, they wrestle for EMML or CMML. I'm not sure which one. Like, I think they're intertwined. I'm not a lucha expert. Sorry, everyone who is a lucha expert is screaming at me right now. But they had the creative names of, you know, Samurai Shiro and Kamikaze Misawa. And I'm just like, yeah. Okay, it's the 80s. It's in Mexico.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's no worse than them going to Canada or the United States and getting something as stereotypical as that either. So
yeah.
He did a lot of like apprenticeship, it seems, under a luchador by the name of La Fiera. If you know.
His time in Mexico is still something that I need to discover read a bit more about. But I do know that, you know, for Misawa, this actually gave him, a big view of the world, a big view of wrestling, and the fact that there was more to it outside of just all Japan or outside of Japan. Because in those days, and I guess it was very much the same in the States as well, companies, they didn't associate with other companies. You know, you went to award shows, you weren't allowed to speak to anybody. Working for one company could completely ruin your chances with the next. And that was going to be something that actually was, went on into actually the early 2000s even. For Misawa, I think that gave him a view of thinking that, well, you know, if it's ever me that's ever in control, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Things can be very different. And that was good because it gave him a more of a world view than the insular one that he'd known in the confines of all Japan.
I found a great quote where, you know, like you touched upon it, that, you know, Baba called Misawa back early from Mexico. He asked him if, can you jump from the corner post? And then when Misawa replied that he could, then he said, okay, come back. Because that's, of course, the way Tiger Mask makes his entrance. Yeah. If you can do that, if you can do the entrance, you're going to be the new Tiger Mask. So from here, like into the spring of 1990, Misawa wrestles as the second incarnation of Tiger Mask following the pioneer of that gimmick, Satoru Sayama, because Giant Baba had purchased the rights to the character from the mangaka Iki Kajiwara. So he had licensed the rights to New Japan for a while with Sayama under the gimmick, and then Baba bought the rights from him. Apparently, Baba was actually a character in the original manga.
Yes. Yeah, Baba did a lot of stuff like that.
His image is very popular here in Japan. Like, if you go to, like, kind of like, retro shops or something like that, you can see, like, you know, Inoki's a lot of places too. Stan Hansen's on a lot of things, but also Baba. I think people thought Baba had a more, like, cuter image, which is, you know, kawaii culture is very big in Japan, has always been. And, you know, Baba's image is a lot more cuter than maybe, like, his cartoon image, at least, is much more cuter than Antonio Inoki's.
Yes. Yeah. You can always find a lot of Baba things, you know. I think they left him because he was kind of like, you know, what they saw as the gentle giant.
So how would you describe, like, you know, we talked about that he wasn't comfortable being Tiger Mask 2. He didn't really like the gimmick. But did the fans take to it? Did they enjoy him being Tiger Mask?
Well, the fact is that no one actually knew it was Misawa. I know it's very hard for, you know, us to perhaps, even if we grew up in the 90s and, you know, born in the 80s, but for anybody who was perhaps born, you know, later than, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, it was a completely different world back then. There was no, you know, internet on phones. You know, we didn't have, you know, you wanted to make a phone call. If you were outside, you'd find a phone box. We didn't have the range of information or social media that we have today. So nobody actually knew it was Misawa. People guessed because they thought, well, that looks like perhaps, you know, his eyes. But until he unmasked, nobody knew. They just fell in love with Tiger Mask. Misawa himself, as I've said, hated the gimmick because he couldn't really see in the mask. It prevented him, you know, it made it difficult for him to do the moves that he'd want to do. And he used to complain to Barbara, you know, how long do I have to do this? You know, Barbara would be like, shh, you know, just tell him to, you know, put up with it. But no, Tiger Mask was not something that Misawa enjoyed.
Maybe he shouldn't have said anything. Maybe Baba would have let him take the mask off sooner. Maybe every time Misawa asked, Baba thought, 6 more months. You're going to be Tiger Mask 6 more months. But Baba was definitely behind this. He would bring a lot of talent to face Misawa as Tiger Mask. He would bring people from Mexico like the aforementioned La Fiera, also luchadores like Jerry Estrada and Parada Morgan. But he would also like poach wrestlers from New Japan, notably Dynamite Kid and Kuniaki Kobayashi, who were famous for feuding with Sayama as Tiger Mask. The thing with Dynamite Kid, he never really had like those series of matches with Misawa as Tiger Mask because of his, you know, his schedule with the WWF at the time didn't really allow him to go back to All Japan enough to really have the feud with him. But Kuniaki Kobayashi, on the other hand, had a great feud with Misawa as Tiger Mask. They would have a great match on June 21st. Misawa would challenge for Kobayashi's NWA International Junior Heavyweight Championship match, and that match was voted the best of the year by the readers of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. So Kobayashi is kind of like the first guy to kind of like take Misawa to another level where he's getting a lot of notice as Tiger Mask.
As much as he hated the gimmick, for Misawa, it was a very good learning curve because it meant that although, you know, he was in this mask, it wasn't him. It meant perhaps he got to do the things that he would, you know, perhaps he wouldn't have done if he didn't have the mask. So I always look at Tiger Mask in that way. Yes, he hated it, but sometimes what you hate is good for you. And that was, I think, a very, very good apt in this situation because it gave him all those things under this character that perhaps Baba would never have thought of for Misawa.
Their feud, the Tiger Mask Kobayashi feud, would culminate on August 31st when Masano would finally win the junior title from Kobayashi, and he would win with one of his signature moves that he debuted in this match, the Tiger Suplex 85.
Yeah. No one had actually ever used suplexes in the way before Misawa did. People just threw them. That was it. They didn't do them repeatedly, and they certainly didn't ever try normally to incorporate them into a pin. And it was the same with the rolling elbow. People just used it. It was Misawa who actually put the finer points on it and turned it into a move.
So after winning the title, he would have a successful defense against Chavo Guerrero Sr. On October 28th. And from there, Baba decided, okay, you're not going to be a junior anymore. You're going to move into the heavyweight class. For a variety of reasons, but mainly because like he was having knee problems because of the offense he used as Tiger Mask.
Yeah. That was the thing about All Japan in that era. Was that one thing that Baba wanted to get the impression was that his wrestlers were monsters. And monsters, they didn't wear knee pads because everyone, it's like the kid at school wearing braces. So you're wearing braces, you're uncool. He didn't like them to wear knee pads. The veterans didn't really approve of it. And there was, and he didn't like them either if they were injured to admit they were injured or ever really go to hospital. Kobayashi remembers after getting almost whipped to death by Hansen and his bones showing through his arm, finding Barbara in the lobby waiting for him and, you know, a, apologizing for it. Barbara understood, but it was one thing that he didn't want. And I think that because of that, there was a lot of unnecessary accumulation that built up in their bodies, because he wanted this image that his wrestlers were indestructible. So, of course, Misawa started developing knee problems. And so what happened was that, you know, Barbara decided, well, I'm going to move you up to the heavyweights now. But like Marufuji said, Misawa had loved being a junior. And he certainly did keep a lot of the elements of that when he turned heavyweight into his wrestling.
So at this point, like, you know, like Misawa as Tiger Mask would be paired with Bappa, and they would go on a bit of a mini excursion, because on April 19th, 1986, they would enter the NWA's Crockett Cup Tag Team Tournament, and which was held at the Louisiana Superdome, and they reached the quarterfinals, where they lost to the eventual second place team of Ronnie Garvin and Magnum TA. And I remember reading about this tournament in one of the aftermags in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, I think. And I cannot for the life of me remember Bappa and Tiger Mask being in this tournament. But then I wasn't really interested in Japanese wrestling at the time. I was like, ooh, the Road Warriors, cool. Oh, look, it's Tully and Arn, or I think it was Tully Blanchard and Lex Luger. But now I have to go find that magazine and look for those pictures again, or look for it. This match, I think it might be on the WWE Network. I can go check there.
Yeah.
But the next day, Misawa was then taken to the American Wrestling Association to their Wrestle Rock 86 event by Stan Hansen. And he would take on Buck Zumhoff, where he would lose that match. But I just think it's just a nice little aside of his career that he got to do some wrestling in America.
Yeah. And also, I think it was helped, because he was a mask wrestler and he had a gimmick. And of course, at that time, we all know it was the golden age of gimmick wrestlers. So again, you know, it's the case of the mask, you know, as much as he hated it, really did boost his career.
Some other asides, interesting notes in 1986, Misawa would continue his association with Bappa as a tag team, and they would enter the World's Strongest Tag Determination League. It's a lot easier saying the Real World Tag League now these days. I mean, can I just say that? I'm glad we don't have to call it the World's Strongest Tag Determination League. By the way, that's going to be WSTDL from the rest of the show, just so everyone knows that. they would do okay. They would tie for sixth place. But in the March of that year, Misawa would have a match against the NWA champion at the time, Ric Flair, his only match with Flair. And then he would transition from being Bappa's partner into Jumbo Tsuruta's partner, the man who told him, finish school first, and then you can join the All Japan Dojo and become a wrestler. This is during a time when, like, Tsuruta had started feuding with his former tag team partner, Jinichiro Tenryu, and this was, like, the main feud at the time in the company. It was, like, Tenryu's Revolution stable taking on, you know, I guess an early version of Tsuruta Gun, though it wasn't called that at the time.
Yeah, Tsuruta, he was kind of like with Barbara, he was like, you know, the seniors. So it was kind of like the logical next step for Misawa to take. He learned from Barbara, he teamed with Barbara. Barbara, of course, you know, was taking a back seat now to his growing stars. So Tsuruta was the logical next step for Misawa to team with, especially now as he was becoming, you know, more of a established heavyweight.
What I think is interesting about that transition is also, like, you create this really clear lineage of Bappa to Jumbo to Misawa. And it's interesting because you can parallel that with Tenryu and Kawada. And so, like, the rivalry of Jumbo and Tenryu is kind of mirrored in their, you know, their apprentices in Misawa and Kawada later on.
Yeah. It's funny how wrestling's always like that. You've got, like, this lineage. If you know, you've got the master pupil, and they kind of, like, you know, correspond with each other, and they feud down the years. It's interesting that dynamic.
On July 3rd, Misawa and Jumbo would win the PWF World Tag Team Championship from the team of Ted DiBiase and Stan Hansen by countout, which, you know, that's back then, like, you could win titles on countouts. And they would only hold those belts for 8 days before dropping them back to DiBiase and Hansen. But Misawa would get one of his biggest singles career at that point in his career by pinning Ted DiBiase on July 19th, and it really goes to show you, like DiBiase is one of the, you know, kind of a big star from America wrestling in All Japan. He's the perennial tag partner of Hansen for the time that he's there. So for Misawa to kind of like this early in his career to get this pinfall over a notable Gaijin is pretty like, you know, kind of a stamp of approval from Baba. Yeah. I think.
Yeah, Baba. What's the word I'm looking for? Now it's completely gone out of my head. Baba, by this time, was actually kind of taking a backseat toward things. You know, he saw the logic in, you know, pushing his younger stars, and he put himself down, you know, down on the card normally, so they could have, you know, opportunities like this. It's kind of sad that in a way, Misawa didn't really learn from this when he was in Noah. Because obviously, you know, with how it was, the titles were only exclusively really for the seniors. But Baba saw it differently. And so for Misawa, this was a pretty big deal.
Continuing on into 1988, on All Japan's first event of that year, Misawa would wrestle then AWA World Heavyweight Champion Curt Hennig. He won by count out, but the title did not change hands. And this was kind of controversial. For the fans in Japan, because like we said before, like titles can change on a count out, but obviously not the AWA world title because it's an American title. But, you know, I'm sure there was like kind of an interesting dynamic there because, you know, earlier, of course, like Jumbo Tsuruta in the 80s was the AWA world champion. And like kind of Curt Hennig would succeed him because he would follow Nick Bockwinkel in that lineage. It would be like Hansen, then Hansen would give up the title, Bockwinkel's the champion, and then Curt Hennig would take the belt from, you know, so from Bockwinkel. And so kind of Hennig is kind of like the AWA version of, you know, what Misawa is to All Japan. Hennig would be to the AWA. So it's kind of interesting to see like these two guys, their past, you know, just collide in like this one-off time. But I still think that that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of just all the, like these, you know, stories to be told and just the way, you know, how things, you know, just worked out. It is fascinating because there's so much behind it and there's so much meaning in it. You know, just, you know, to write about, to look into, to think about. There's a lot there.
And on March 8th, 1989, he would have another really interesting match. He would get a shot at the NWA World Heavyweight title, then held by Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Of course, he would lose that match. But also, like, he would suffer, like, some serious, like, injuries. He tore his left ACL during the match, and he was inactive for the rest of 1989.
Yeah. This is when Misawa's sense of humor actually, first of all, came to the fore. Because there are pictures of him, you know, obviously he's wearing the tiger mask in the hospital bed, his knee bandaged and everything. So Misawa used to make, you know, make rude jokes about it. And I think that's partly because of what, you know, his humour. And I think that was also partly because, as I said, he didn't like the gimmick and he wanted to, you know, that take a stab. But, you know, Tiger Mask was just this good and pure guy because Misawa started saying that, you know, did he read in the hospital? He said, yes, he read rude books.
I see.
Yeah, so that was kind of Misawa's rebellion against it.
Well, what's Baba going to do? Fire him? No, I mean, this guy's the future of his company. So Misawa would be out for the rest of 1989, but he would come back early in 1990. And on February 10th, he would wrestle for the first time inside the Tokyo Dome, not on an All Japan show. He would do it for a New Japan event because what would happen was that, you know, and New Japan was going to do a show, I think, was it with WCW? And things fell apart. So then president of New Japan, Seiji Sakaguchi, called Baba and he said, come, please help me with this show, please, please. And Baba agreed only if on the condition that no one could beat his wrestlers and they couldn't be made to look bad. So it was Misawa teaming with Tenryu. Was this the only time they ever teamed?
I'm not really too sure. I think it may have been one of the rare occasions that they did. I know that obviously you have the whole, you know, Misawa versus, you know, Tenryu Revolution. But it must have been. Because I can't think of another instance when they might have done.
I don't think they ever teamed. Possibly, I think they were on opposite sides when Tenryu would appear in Noah. Yeah. But it's an interesting dynamic that they would take on the team of George Sakano and Riki Choshu. They would win that match by count out. And like in front of a very impressive attendance, it's listed as 53,000 people. But you never know. Back then, it could have been like 40,000. They just said, there's an extra 13,000 people in here. But we'll just give it to them. Yeah. There's 53,000 people in this building to watch this match. And I'm sure it was a really good feeling for Masao. Oh my God. Like all these people came, are here not to see me necessarily, but like I'm wrestling in front of this many people. It must've inspired him to like, I can achieve this again one day when I'm a big star.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot, there was a lot in this era for him, that I think that did boost him personally. But by now he was getting weary of, people saying, Tiger Mask achieved this, Tiger Mask achieved that. When actually what he wanted was the people to say, well, that was Misawa who did that. The man behind the mask. And of course, nobody knew it was Misawa.
And if people are like listening to this and thinking, my God, I got to see this match where Tenryu and Misawa teamed up, take on George Sakano and Choshu. probably you won't be able to find this because of television contracts, All Japan's on different channel than New Japan. This match was never aired. So
no,
I don't think you're, exciting. I don't think it exists on tape.
No. And also as well, there was a chance that it could have been, perhaps, but after the fallout with Mrs. Barber, which we'll get to, there were reasons why it wasn't.
From here, Misawa would team with Kenta Kobashi, and they would win the All-Asia Tag Team titles from the Can-Am Express, the team of Dan Crawford and Doug Furness. And 4 days later, after that, Misawa would wrestle Bret Hart to a time limit draw at the WWF, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and All Japan Pro Wrestling Super Show in the Dome. And I've seen this match, Asami, and when I saw this match, I knew, Misawa was Tiger Mask and he was wrestling Bret Hart. And you can't imagine the anticipation I had. And then you can't even imagine the disappointment I felt after watching this match.
Yeah, it's, let's say, for example, it's not up there.
It's like oil and water. I mean, I love Bret Hart. Like he's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. And then I was so into Misawa. So I thought, oh my God, they're going to have like an All Japan style match. Little did I realize at that age, like, no, Bret Hart would never work the All Japan style. It's not for him.
It's on paper. You'd look at it and you think, oh my gosh, this is going to be awesome. This will be a great, this will be a great technical match. But it never actually works out that way because they kind of seem unsure of each other and one style clashes with the other. And you do come away from it thinking, okay, well, could have been better. It just doesn't work.
No, unfortunately. I still love both, though. I still love Bret Hart. I still love Misawa. But I don't think I'd ever revisit that match again.
No.
So, but things are looking up for Misawa because, later in April, Tenryu would say, hey, Baba, I got this deal with this eyeglass company, and I'm going to go do something with them. And that turned out to be Super World Sports. And Baba was like, you can never come back to this company ever again. You betrayed me. And so, he would also take Tenryu would take some other people with him. He would take Fuyuki. He would take Yoshiaki Yatsu. He would take Asahara Hara. So he took a lot, like some of the mid-card with him, including Tenryu's peers. So like Bob was like in this quandary, I only have Jumbo left as like my native, the only native star. Cause he's going to build a company around Jumbo. And then later on, like, I think Tenryu was going to be the guy after Jumbo had kind of like winded down as he's reaching his mid-40s. But that didn't happen. So like Baba, and this is probably the greatest thing that ever happened to All Japan, because Baba was now forced to look at his younger wrestlers, and he thought, I need to elevate them. And who did he pick to be the first guy he would really elevate? That was, of course, Mitsuhara Misawa.
Yeah. Baba by this time had to take real stock of things, because All Japan had had what was known as the first Exodus. you know, Tenryu was told to go and never come back, and he took a lot of the established stars with him. So Bob thought, okay, I'm going to have to start from scratch. What do I have? I have Misawa. You know, I have Jumbo. I have the up-and-coming Kawada. I have Kobashi. You know, I've got a lot of young boys in there. Now, what do I want to do? What he decided then, and this was basically the essence of the four pillars, was that he wanted to have, you know, a roster, you know, just, you know, perhaps four guys in particular who were going to show the All Japan style. They were going to show the Japanese, you know, the Japanese way of wrestling. They were going to win matches by, you know, pinfall, not necessarily submission. There was going to be no foul play. There was going to be no, you know, no count outs. This was going to be, you know, just a fight, and this is where it all came from. All Japan's fight to survive, because see, now they were dealing with both New Japan and this new promotion led by the incredibly popular Tenryu. Barber had to take stock of things and think, well, okay, I've got also as well, things are changing here. You know, we've got the, you know, American wrestling is gaining popularity as other martial arts sports beginning. You know, I'm going to have to start from scratch and reevaluate.
So one thing to note is that, you know, several years earlier, you know, like, you know, it was really popular in Japan, and particularly in All Japan, for like all these false finishes, all these like, you know, terrible finishes to happen, count outs, DQs, yeah. Because no one wanted to lose and no one wanted to lose cleanly.
No.
So Baba, you know, the story is Baba, you know, like had some, you know, like they would do these matches with Tenryu and Jumbo in the early history of the Triple Crown. And like the fans were getting angry at these non-finishes. But yeah. Also the other aspect of it is like Baba saw the popularity of the UWFI and the shoot style, and they were all clean finishes. And he's seeing them sell out the big venues in Tokyo and across Japan. He's like thinking, I got to do this. This is what I have to do. Like I want to, I'm going to institute clean finish, you know, policy in my company. And to his benefit, like he had this new crop of wrestlers that were going to pick up from where like Jumbo and Tenryu had started this trend. And then they were going to take it to a different level where like, and then, you know, it's part of the reason like All Japan became one of the hotbed of in-ring, you know, action, because you didn't get the stupid finishes that you get in American wrestling or other parts of the world, and things that were still happening to some extent in New Japan, even at that time. So, you know, it's kind of like this confluence of like, you know, like this perfect storm kind of, Hisami.
Baba had the ability to actually look around and see what was happening. He always said, you know, as a wrestler, you have to listen to what your fans want. You have to listen to what the crowd wants. It's not a case of, people will like what I will tell them to like. It's a case of, well, this is what people want to see. And if you can't connect with your fans, you know, if you can't connect as a wrestler with your fans, as a promoter, then what hope do you have? You're forcing something on people that they don't want. And that was a lot of his philosophy. You know, time's changing. You have to change with it. But you also have to be able to read your audience. And what the audience wanted was, you know, this pure fight, which then they got out of All Japan.
So then we move on to a very pivotal date for Misawa, May 14th, 1990. It's a tag match. He's teaming with Kawada, and they're taking on the soon-to-be-departed Yoshiaki Yatsu and Samson Fuyuki. And during this match, you know, Misawa tells Kawada, hey, take this thing off my head. Take this thing off my head. And then Kawada, it's a clip you see all the time with regards to Misawa. It's Kawada unmasking, taking like untying the strings at the back, and then Misawa takes it off and just whips it out of the ring. Like you can see, I'm done with this. And then he just starts going to town on Yatsu and Fuyuki. And this is like one of the, you know, like, you know, the highlights of Misawa's career is to take that mask off finally.
Yeah. That's like the moment I think Misawa was truly born, the moment the Four Pillars were born, the moment, you know, Japan turned that corner. And it entered into what people called, you know, the golden age, the golden era, the era, the Four Pillars of the Shiteno wrestling. That is when it really began. Misawa said in an interview afterwards, he said, I took that stupid mask off and I could finally go back to being Misawa.
So after this match, which he and Kawada won, he would then challenge his childhood hero, Jumbo Tsuruta, to a singles match, because he's ready to, you know, go to the next level in his career. So at this time, let's talk briefly about what kind of relationship did Misawa have with Giant Baba, and what kind of relationship did he have with, you know, Jumbo Tsuruta? Because these are two guys who are, you know, like kind of, you know, his mentors.
All Japan was actually had a, after, you know, the seniors had departed and obviously leaving only perhaps Tsuruta, it began to take on a very kind of a feeling of a family. And it attracted a lot of what I would call wastes and strays. For example, if we look at, you know, Misawa's childhood, you know, his father was violent. He didn't see him after he was 8 years old. Kobashi's father was absent. I don't know about Kawada, and Tawa seemed to have a happy enough childhood. Ogawa, his father was very harsh. I think in Onita's case, his parents had divorced, and the Barbas themselves couldn't have children because they were scared that, you know, child would have Barbas, inherit Barbas' condition. But it may also have been that he was perhaps, I don't know, infertile. But for whatever reason, Baba kind of became, you know, the father of the dojo. And, you know, Makoto was, you know, the strict mom. But it gave people a very family atmosphere. It gave them the family that they didn't have when they were growing up. They had the indulgent dad and they had, you know, the strict mom. And I think that's what attracted a lot of those people to all Japan. So it was a very kind of, you know, fatherly atmosphere, family atmosphere there. But his relationship with Baba was, over the years, Baba discovered that he could actually grow to trust Misawa very much. And as Baba became, you know, more frail, much to perhaps, you know, Motoko's disapproval, Baba actually began to trust Misawa with more of the booking, with more of how the business ran. And at one point, they actually wanted to legally adopt him as Baba's heir. In which case he would have had to have changed his name to, you know, Mitsuharu Baba. They approached it with Misawa, and he said, "No, I don't like that idea at all. You know, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to do it." But after that, they always used to refer to him as, you know, like as Baba being, you know, his father who loved him, and it was a very, very family, very paternal atmosphere.
What about with Misawa's relationship with Jumbo Tsuruta?
Tsuruta, it was more of a kind of a master-pupil relationship. I don't think you had that father element there. But when Tsuruta died, Misawa was there at the airport to support the family and to, you know, help bring Tsuruta's body back to Japan. But after that, because obviously we all know he died due to issues caused by a failed organ transplant, Misawa by then with Noah, he struck up an association they still have with the Japanese Organ Association, with Misawa saying that, you know, no one ever again in Japan, you know, if I can support them in this, we'll ever want again for any kind of organ, any kind of transplant. And this is, Noah still have association with the association today. So it was very much a case of, I think with him, a very strong bond of, you know, teacher and pupil.
A lot of mutual respect between the two because, you know, like, you know, Misawa would do that for, you know, for the create the association with the Organ Transplant Society of Japan as a way to honor Jumbo. But like Jumbo would really go to task for Misawa by, you know, supporting him to become the next president of all Japan.
Yes.
after Baba dies. And this kind of like angers Mrs. Baba because like then Jumbo is kind of banished from the board of directors without any severance pay. And I would assume that's a retaliation against him supporting Misawa instead of Mitsuo Momota.
Yeah, she could be. She was a very complicated woman because I think as a little girl, she'd actually been very headstrong. She'd been very willful, and she'd actually been very spoilt. She fell in love with Baba when she was a teenager, and her father didn't approve of the relationship at all. But as ever, you know, Toko got her way, and. She wasn't much liked backstage, although she was capable of extremely kind actions. She was a very loving woman, especially towards Baba, whose, you know, gowns that she made herself. And She would arrange for, you know, the Gaijin wrestlers to, you know, to celebrate, you know, Thanksgiving. But she could also be very unforgiving. Kawada described her once as, you know, being like a water boiler. She could just erupt in fury at any moment. Barber was also aware of her failings, and he'd actually asked referee Kyohei Wada to stay in All Japan and, you know, support her, because he knew that when he was gone, there was nothing that was going to hold back herself and Misawa, who'd never really gotten on, you know, and the All Japan that he would built, you know, was going to change. And he asked him to stay on. He said, well, I know her personality, you know, can be harsh. He said, but it can't be that harsh. There's going to be nobody that's going to stay and, you know, and look after her.
Right. So going back to Misawa's career, so he's challenged Jumbo to this match, a singles match, but and the rest of the tour would then build up to this Misawa Tsuruta singles match. And, you know, the way they built it up is through a series of legendary six-man tag matches featuring Misawa, Kawada, Kenny Kobashi, and I think Tawa is still in this group, and also Tsuyoshi Kikuchi, the Super Generation Army, and they're taking on the you know, Jumbo Tsuruta stable, Tsuruta Gun, which at that time, let me see, it's Jumbo, it's Masanobu Fuchi, it's the great Kabuki, and one more person. I can't remember who the third person is, like one of the mid-carder older guys.
Yeah. But
that dynamic would change later on with the addition of Tawa, and it just made that whole feud go to another level, because it was great that Jumbo took on Tawa as his new disciple, because like Tawa, I think he knew he was going to get lost being the fourth guy in a group of Misawa, Kawada, and Kobashi. He knew he was going to be number four. Like Kikuchi, because he's a junior, he's going to be number five on the totem pole. but being number four isn't that great either. But he knew if he joins Jumbo, he's going to be number two in that group, which is not a bad place to be in the All Japan roster.
Kobashi once summed up the dynamic between the four pillars as, you know, Misawa was obviously, he was a leader. Kawada had this huge rivalry with Misawa because, you know, he was felt, you know, he always felt inferior to him. Kobashi was kind of like, you know, in between them, stroke third. For him, you know, he didn't have the background that they did. So he always felt that he had to, you know, catch up, overtake, overcome. And then there was Tawa. He said that, you know, Tawa, lovely personality, but he wasn't really interested in, you know, overcoming anybody or catching up or anything like that. He said, you know, Tawa was Tawa. He was just laid back.
He just, hey, I just want to wrestle.
Oh, yeah. And even that, you know, you could never get him to train. Even when he joined All Japan, his trainer from Sumo actually said, you know, Tawa is lovely. He said, but you'll never get him to train.
Well, I will say this, just as a tangent here. When I first started watching All Japan, I'm like, yeah, Misawa, wow, Kobashi, whoa, Kawada, oh man, that guy looks tough. Tawa, I don't get it. Yeah. You know, it's not later. I gained a deeper appreciation for Tawa now, but at the time I was like, because I kind of am a body guy, you know, like I judge people, I judge wrestlers by their looks, and it's like, why is he in this group? Why is he on all these matches? But he is actually, regardless, he doesn't want to train. He's still an amazing wrestler, and he is. He's such a great wrestler.
Papa once took everyone to the beach to train. Everyone turned up with their wrestling gear. It's Avatawe who turned up at the beach with sandals. And, you know, Barbara said to him, what is that? Where are your trainers? And Tawa said, why would I bring trainers to the beach? Because it never occurred to him that that they weren't going to do anything other than sunbathe. So he bought his sandals with him.
Smart man. Smart man. Yeah. Let's go to May 26th, Sasami. And this is a very, very famous match. It's Jumbo Tsuruta, Tsuruta Gun, taking on the Super Generation Army of Misawa, Kobashi, and Akira Tawa. And for the most part, Tsuruta's kind of like just being a dick to everyone in this match, including like he's knocking off Kobashi and Tawa off the apron. But it's this one moment in the match that's really famous, because he makes a mistake of like provoking Misawa by just tapping him on the shoulder. And what does Misawa do?
Misawa goes mad. Oh, his reaction. something that you have to see to believe it, but it is worth seeing.
So if you listen to the previous episode that I did with JP Hulan, we covered the famous singles match between Jumbo and Misawa, and this we talked a bit about this match, and this is the birth of the elbow. This is you know, Misawa basically knocks the shit out of Jumbo. He knocks him off the apron, and it gets this move over. This elbow is now the deadliest weapon in all Japan Pro Wrestling. And think about that. It's like, this is a company that has, you know, like Jumbo's lariats. It has Stan Hansen's lariats. It's got Kobashi's chops. It's got Kawada's kicks. It's got Taue, like, chokeslamming everyone. But the deadliest thing in this company now, because of Jumbo selling it, and the way Misawa, you know, executes the elbow strike, is this elbow that's like covered in a black, you know, elbow pad. But it's like, my God, you don't want to get hit with this thing. And it's the thing that's going to help him win a lot of his matches throughout the rest of his career.
Yeah. It's just how Misawa does it as well, because it just comes out of nowhere. And you just sink it and you think, well, you know, just what did he do? He just, you know, did that to wind you up. And this is your reaction.
And from this match, we then move on to, of course, June 8th, 1990. And like I said before, Isami, like the previous episodes, I went to really in depth on this match. If you want to know more about like the background of this match and the review of the match itself, please listen to that episode. But just, you know, briefly touch upon the background of, like, you know, Baba's decision. This is the match where, you know, he decides Masao's going to pin Jumbo Tsuruta. And what, you know, like what prompted Baba to make that decision?
I think by this time, you know, Baba wanted to shake things up. He wanted to show that there was such a thing in his company, at least, where, you know, the younger generation, they could overcome the older generation, and that the unthinkable, the impossible could happen. I think, you know, fans were begging for it, so he was just going to give them a taste of what they wanted.
And he would do that. He, you know, Misawa defeated Jumbo in this legendary 24-minute match, and then this would start the trend of, you know, sellouts at the Budokan. Like, you know, the decision to push Misawa as the new up-and-coming ace, he's not there yet, but like people see, like, okay, he's on his way, Baba's behind him, the company is behind him, he's not gonna like create this new generation of guys. Because like, I think also what people have to understand is, like, it's not only Misawa that's getting elevated. It's Kawada, it's Kobashi, it's Taue are getting elevated as well. And they're seeing, like, the dawn of, like, then there's this group of fans who I'm sure started watching when they were kids, and now they're, you know, teenagers or young adults. And they're seeing, like, oh my God, I'm seeing people that are going to be my Jumbos, my Tenrus, my, you know, my Stan Hansons, my Abdullah Butchers, my Masanobu Fuchis and stuff like that. And they're seeing it with the Super Generation Army, who would later become morph into the four pillars of heaven. Yeah. And I'm sure I got to think, like, I kind of wish if I had a time machine, I would go back. This is one of the time periods I would go back to. Just go to Korakuen Hall and Budokan Hall all the time in the early 90s. Because, like, I'm sure it must have been, for a wrestling fan, the most exciting period.
It was wild. It was a new thing. It was, you know, Baba was introducing this, you know, this fight. It was a vicious fight, but it was a fight. It was one where you didn't think, oh great, yeah, seconds are going to interfere again, here we go with the chair. It was nothing like that, because although, you know, there was, you didn't have that element, which perhaps, I don't know, people in today's wrestling, you know, might find boring, I don't know, but what, you know, never ever made it boring was because that you could expect the unexpected. You know, you could see these crazy moves, which weren't, you know, flips, you know, moonsaults or anything like that. You know, you could see the most vicious elbows. You could see just how far their endurance was going to go. And you knew that it was going to end with basically one guy just knocking out the other. It was that.
Yeah, and it's just like, and it's like the adoption of like clean finishes in All Japan. You were guaranteed a good match, like, you know, if it might not be a long match, but at least you weren't guaranteed like a DQ or you know, double count or anything like that. It was going to be a clean finish one way or the other, which I think is the most, you know, one of the more appealing things to see in a wrestling match is a decisive winner and loser. So from here we have, you know, Misawa makes his first challenge for the vacant Triple Crown. He's taking on Stan Hansen. And the story behind this is that, you know, he was supposed to face Terry Gordy, but Terry Gordy had the drug overdose, I believe, and then so he has to vacate the title. You know, Baba can't trust him.
He'd got drunk and had a kind of a cardiac episode.
Oh, okay. It was through alcohol. Okay, but I think he has a drug episode later on. I think
he'd been drinking, and I think he'd be like in Shinjuku or somewhere. But anyway, he'd been hospitalized because he drunk too much. So the card had to be changed.
So it's now Stan Hansen taking on Misawa, and in Baba's eyes, Misawa's not ready for that title yet. So it's Hansen who becomes the new Triple Crown champion. Misawa then moves on to September 1st, and he's facing Jumbo again in a rematch, this time to determine the number one contender to the Triple Crown, and he would lose that match. Some people say, I don't know, like, let me ask your opinion. Some people like think this match, the September 1st match between Jumbo and Misawa, is better than the earlier match.
No, I don't think that. I think they're still on the same level because they've got the same hunger in it from Misawa, in the fact that, you know, he has to overcome. And I think, you know, by that time, Saruta has, you know, learned a little more about this new Misawa and is ready for them. That's what always gives the edge to this match. So it means that the next time they meet, Misawa is going to have to pull something pretty special out. And as we know, he does.
Yes. And from this point, Misawa is regularly teaming with Kawada. Like, Kawada and him are the regular, like, the A-team of Super Generation Army, whereas Kobashi and Kikuchi are kind of like the B-team. So, you know, Misawa's clear number one in the group, and Kawada's his number two. So they enter the WSTDL, and they make it to the finals. On the final day, they make it to a final match with Jumbo Tsuruta and Akira Taue, the Tsurugan team. And they place third in the overall standings of this tournament. So it's an okay, you know, result from Misawa and Kawada here, but it's not like what they would, you know, achieve later on in later years. And in a match against Taue on January 26, 1991, this is the match that I referenced earlier. He wins the match against Taue by using the Tiger Driver 91. So just for people who might not know what the Tiger Driver 91 is, Isami, I'm just going to describe it quickly. So the regular Tiger Driver is you get a double underhook, like you might do a butterfly suplex, but you lift the guy kind of in a, like, almost like in a power bomb move, and then you drop the person flat on their back. The Tiger Driver 91 is similar to that, except you don't drop the person flat on their back. You drop them straight on their head.
Yeah.
And God bless Taue for taking this move the first time, because he doesn't know. I'm sure Misawa's like, yeah, just tuck your head. Just tuck your chin. It'll be okay. you're dropping on my head. Yeah, just tuck. It's okay. We tuck our heads all the time. So, you know, the timing that, like, guys like Taue, Kawada, and Kobashi have to hit, like, and this is after wrestling maybe 25, 30 minutes of just beating the hell out of each other, that they have to remember to make sure they tuck their heads so they don't break their necks with Misawa dropping them directly on their heads is kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah. There was a lot of, in All Japan, one of the things that they always used to put emphasis on was neck training. Because there is footage of Kobashi training where basically somebody is standing on his neck and he's lifting his head up and down.
I think that's like standard in all Japanese pro wrestling dojos in 2020 there. Training the neck. from here, we continue into 91 and we go into the Champions Carnival, and he enters the 1991 edition of that tournament, and he places second in his block. He would then later challenge Jumbo Tsuruta for the Triple Crown on April 18th in the main event of a sold-out Budokan show. Actually, this set an attendance record at the time, but he lost to Jumbo again in singles competition for the Triple Crown. So, you know, like, Baba's kind of really teasing this, you know, this big win that, you know, that's what people want to see. They want to see not only Misawa beat Jumbo again, but they want to see him win the Triple Crown from Jumbo.
Yeah. And it's good booking on Baba's part that he didn't actually make it happen straight away. You know, he was kind of carrot and stick, saying, you know, this is what, you know, you, okay, I know that you want to see this, but, you know, let's play this out. Let's, you know, let's draw this out. And it did it. You know, it would have been wasted had Misawa just, you know, won it perhaps first time simply because he was Misawa. It's good booking on Baba's part to actually, you know, build those higher levels until he felt fine. Okay, yes, you know, anything more, people are going to start losing interest. You know, here is the time to do it. And it told a very, very good story. Because each kind of match they had, you could tell that, you know, that Misawa was going to have to go that extra mile if he wanted to overcome Saruta, because Saruta knew him so well, he trained him, and he was, you know, he was ready for him.
And, you know, he's not doing so well in the singles competition in terms of, like, getting the Triple Crown, but on July 24th, 1991, him and Kawada would defeat the Miracle Violence Connection, the team of Dr. Dusty Williams and Bam Bam Terry Gordy, for their first World Tag Team titles. And then they would make their first defense of those titles against Jumbo Tsuruta and Akira Taue on September 4th at the Budokan Hall. And this is where Misawa historically forces Jumbo to tap out to his face lock move. And that's this is the move you were talking about, referencing earlier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because people were, you know, you very rarely saw that happened in that caliber of match in All Japan. So people couldn't believe it. You know, even Saruta couldn't believe it. And there was a bit of, you know, like comedy backstage when Saruta said something like, "Oh, wait a minute, I tapped out." He said, "Did that really happen?" I mean, Misawa joked something like, "Well, yes, it's all on video, isn't it? You know, you can watch the footage if you want. It did happen." But it was a huge, you know, it was a huge deal. It was, you know, it was kind of like, wow, you know, Misawa did what to who? It was a massive thing.
Well, I mean, it's really, you know, goes to show like how unselfish Jumbo is. Like, first of all, he gets the elbow over by, like, you know, practically being unconscious in the six-man tag. And then he gets this face lock over by actually, you know, he taps to it. Like, you can visibly see him tapping Misawa's arm, and that's where that signals for the referee to call for the bell. And, like, people are, like, shocked. Oh, my God, Jumbo submitted?
Yeah. People couldn't believe it. I mean, if you watch the you know, the crowd reaction, it's kind of like, you know, and it's an uproar. You know, people, you very rarely saw this in All Japan, especially in those level of matches. And it was, in its day, it was very shocking.
Misawa would continue his tag team with Kawada. They would enter the WSTDL again, and they lost to the Miracle Violence Connection on March 4th, 1992 at the Budokan Hall. This had a record attendance at that time of 16,300 people. That would happen in the final. Sorry, March 4th, 1992, Misawa unsuccessfully challenges Stan Hansen again for the Triple Crown. It's still eluding him in the 1992 Champion Carnival. Misawa finally reaches the finals of this tournament, but he has, like, this kind of important date, like, in his career on April 2nd before the finals. He would wrestle Jumbo Tsuruta in what would be their final singles match, and it went to a 30-minute time limit draw, so there was no decisive winner in this match, and this is the last time they would wrestle each other in a singles match.
I think that was kind of a good way to, you know, to cap it off, because he obviously, you know, to finish the story. I think that was kind of like the perfect way to finish it, because by now they were on a level. You know, Tsuruta was aware that, you know, of the levels Misawa would go to beat him, and Misawa was aware of the fact that, you know, Tsuruta, while he knew him very well, you know, he could still be very, very wary, you know, of him, because Misawa had been able, you know, in the past to both to pin him and to do the unthinkable, to make him tap. I think just, you know, anything other than a draw would just have unbalanced it. It would just have, I think, have just, it just wouldn't have finished it. And I think it would have left people wanting more for what they didn't have, you know, what they weren't going to get. But I think a draw was just a perfect way to finish it, because it showed, as I'd said, they were now on a level. Misawa had come that far, and Tsuruta, you know, was able to bow out against Misawa without, you know, either a final win or just, you know, people wanting more, or a defeat hanging over him. So I think the draw worked well.
Right. Like, obviously, you can work that kind of a draw, that kind of a finish in the Champions Carnival, and it doesn't hurt either guy, like you're saying. Yeah. But do you think, because this was their last ever singles match, because Jumbo would contract hepatitis, he would have to, you know, his days as a main eventer are over. He has to get the organ transplant, the liver transplant, and he would die from kidney transplant. Yeah. He would die from complications for that. And some people would argue, like, in hindsight, you know, hindsight's 20/20, obviously, but some people would argue maybe Baba should have done the match where Misawa beat Jumbo for the Triple Crown. Obviously, he doesn't know that these things are going to happen. Jumbo Tsuru's career. Because I think if he did, if he had that hindsight, if he was able to look in the future and then go back and rebook this, I think he would have had, you know, Jumbo put over Misawa for the Triple Crown earlier.
I think that probably may have been perhaps, you know, what Barber would have planned if things didn't turn out the way they were. But I think for what they were at the time, I think the draw worked well. Obviously, no one could predict the future, what would happen. But I think just, you know, very, very sadly, you know, with all of the, you know, these, I always think, you know, with all of these results, these matches, veterans putting the youngsters over, it was just very sadly something that Misawa seemed not to have picked up very much when in Noah.
So, but he would win the Triple Crown in 1992 on August 22nd, but he wouldn't do it from Jumbo. He would do it against, you know, kind of Jumbo's peer in the company, his equivalent, the Gaijin equivalent of Jumbo Tsuru, which would be Stan Hansen. And so, like, Stan Hansen's the one who, you know, does the honors for Misawa, and he puts him over, and, like, this is the start of, like, you know, five legendary reigns that Misawa would have with this title. But what can you tell me about Misawa's relationship with Stan Hansen?
I don't think that they were, you know, particularly, I don't think, you know, they were particularly close or anything like that. I think, you know, they enjoyed absolutely being rivals. I don't really think they had a particularly close relationship. I think, you know, there was, I think Hansen was actually more involved with Kobashi, as far as I know, than he was with Misawa. But they were, yeah, that's really all I really know about it.
Okay, that's fair enough. So then with the with him winning the title, he would have his first defense against, you know, his tag team partner, who would later become his greatest rival, Toshiaki Kawada, at Budokan Hall. He and Kawada would also win the 1992 WSTDL, and they would defeat the team of Akira Taue and a young Jun Akiyama. I think he just debuted several months earlier before this match, but it's like obviously like Baba saw something in him right away.
Yeah. Akiyama had actually joined All Japan. He was thinking about becoming a wrestler, but he also had a job in an office lined up. And this is a very typical Akiyama story. He was on a train late at night, and he saw a businessman slumped in his seat, fast asleep, drooling. And Akiyama looked at him and thought, there's no way I'm ending up like that. So he actually joined. So he joined All Japan. There was something that happened at his induction, but I think it was along the case that Barber took one look at him, and he knew that he was right for All Japan. I think what he liked about Akiyama was the fact that Akiyama had a kind of what Kobashi said, that people said they used to think he was a little bit strange, but what Barber loved about Akiyama was his individuality, which I think won him over.
I mean, like, you know, like he, if you watch any of his interviews and, you know, like see him now, it's like, yeah, you can see that in like Akiyama in 2020 for sure.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that it was manifested early in his life at a young age. So we're now moving into like kind of like the next level of Misawa's career. And this is like where he splits off with Toshiaki Kawada. Baba decides, okay, Jumbo's sick. We can't push him as a main eventer. I need a new rival, main rival for Misawa, and that's going to be Toshiaki Kawada. So, you know, Kawada has a very grueling match with Akira Taue that goes to a time limit draw. They had been rivals in the Tsurugan versus Super Generation Army, but, you know, in this match, they made peace with each other. They showed respect to each other. And from then on, Kawada would ally himself with the remnants of Tsurugan, and they and make a form a regular tag team with Akira Taue called the Holy Demon Army. By the way, one of the greatest team names in the history of professional wrestling anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And they would feud with the remnants of the Super Generation Army, which now were, you know, Misawa, Kobashi is his new second, and then Tsuyoshi Kikuchi, and then, you know, maybe some of the younger guys were, you know, kind of like their seconds and stuff like that. But these guys were then feuding with, you know, the Holy Demon Army, which is, you know, Kawada, Taue, and, you know, a still active Masanobu Fuchi. So he's now shifted from being aligned with Jumbo to being aligned with Kawada, which is really interesting to see, because these two would, like, go to war with each other in those Super Generation Army Suriken matches. So it's I thought it was really brilliant that like the way to make, you know, Kawada Misawa's rival is to break him off from Super Generation Army and feel like kind of like they felt betrayed that he's now teaming up with Tawei and Fuchi.
Yeah. Baba was a very good booker because he was able to, you know, look at the whole picture and kind of, you know, read what people wanted, you know, read what the fans wanted, read what would keep them, you know, what would keep them interested in the product that was now facing a lot of competition from, you know, a lot of rivals and a lot of outside sources, you know, and things that he had to build up as well. So it was a very, very good move. And it played on this natural rivalry between Misawa and Kawada.
The other memorable event would be the 1993 Champion Carnival, and Misawa again reached the finals, and he would face Hansen again. And this time, Hansen wins again. He defeats him for a second Carnival victory on April 21st in Yokohama. So again, like, you know, Baba's putting off not only him, you know, like, you know, he put off him winning the Triple Crown until recently. Now he's putting off him actually achieving the Champion Carnival. And a lot of other companies, like in New Japan, you would win, like, for example, the G1 Climax, and then you become the IWGP Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have it the other way around. You become the champion, but, like, that tournament win is just, I got to get it. But, like, you would delay the inevitable just to make that final victory so much sweeter.
Yeah, and this is what Baba was a master at, you know, at building things up of, you know, it didn't matter, you know, how long it took. You know, and this guy's, we're talking about, it was quite a few years. You know, okay, everyone wants to see, try again. Everyone wants, okay, it's happening again. Will it happen this time? You know, it happens again. Let's have a look. And he bought it out when it was necessary. He saved it for special occasions. You know, it wasn't, you know, kind of a weekly thing or anything like that. You know, people tune in to see if it's going to happen this week. He saved it and thus he built it, you know, and it kept people, you know, saying, "Oh, I remember the last time. Is it going to be?" And that's because he knew how to build things and how to, you know, and not rush them. And this was a great build up. It kept happening. People kept waiting. They kept waiting. And once again, we were waiting for more.
Yeah, it's delaying that inevitable, like you're saying. Baba was like a master of booking things like that. And it's kind of like something that, you know, I think Misawa took into his own booking career when he would form Pro Wrestling Noah. Yeah. From here, you know, by 1993, like, Kobashi has now become Misawa's tag team partner, and they would see a lot of success as a tag team. They would enter the tag league in 1993. They would defeat Kawada and Tawei in the finals, and they would also win the World Tag Team Championships in this match, and this is the first time that they would become tag team partners. Now, for me, my favorite tag team of Misawa's in this period, like, he has four main ones. It's the one with Kawada, the one with Kobashi, the one with Akiyama, and the one with Yoshinari Ogawa. My favorite tag team with Misawa was with Kobashi, because I think they complemented each other very well.
They did. Misawa had a hand in training Kobashi, and again, it goes back to this whole All Japan, you know, as a family thing, because he was the senior student of Baba. Kobashi used to address him as a Nisan, which, as you know, means older brother. So again, you know, they had this very kind of, you know, they had a rivalry, but underneath it, they had like this very kind of close relationship. And Kobashi used to say that whether they tagged or whether they had, you know, one of their famously brutal matches, Misawa was always open to listening, you know, what Kobashi suggested, what Kobashi had to say. And he said that, you know, if Misawa hadn't, you know, done that, had he just brushed me off, had he not listened, then things would never have, there would never have been in any form a Kobashi and Misawa, you know, simply because they had that relationship. You know, out of the ring, Misawa thought it was very funny to get country boy Kobashi drunk. And, you know, Kobashi was never, you know, scared to play the occasional prank on Misawa or tease him. So I think they had this kind of, you know, this relationship that Misawa didn't have with, you know, with Kawada. It was one that, you know, that was no less intense, but this was just a very kind of different one.
Right, definitely, like, you can see more of a rivalry, but not so much hatred between Misawa and Kobashi as you did with Misawa and Kawada.
No,
but we should remind everyone that right now in 1993, Misawa is in the middle of his first Triple Crown reign. It's an epic one. It's the longest one in the Triple Crown's history at 705 days. And as part of this legendary run, he would have a match with Kawada at Budokan on June 3rd. And it was Kawada's third challenge for the title. And it would be the final successful defense of Misawa's first Triple Crown reign that lasted 705 days before losing it to Dr. Dusty Williams on July 28th in 1994. And it is one of these like things like he held this belt for about 2 years and just short of 2 years and like 705 days. But he's also, you know, he's also holding the world tag team titles. He's like doing well in the carnival. He's doing well in the tag league. And it's a busy, busy time to be Mitsuhara Misawa in All Japan.
Yeah, and by this time as well, he was starting to take on additional backstage duties because he was helping out Baba. And although he and Mrs. Baba had actually never really gotten along, this is a time when the seeds of the future resentment were sown because he was starting to help Baba with more and more. And she didn't really like it because she thought that, you know, what Baba had were his rights, you know, were being taken away. So this was really when the seeds were beginning to sown of, you know, what was going to become the second exodus of from All Japan.
Right. So jumping into 1995, Misawa enters the Champion Carnival that year and he finally wins the carnival against Taue on April 15th. He then would regain the Triple Crown, this time against Stan Hansen. He ended Hansen's fourth and final Triple Crown reign. So it's kind of like, you know, this is like Hansen's final passing of the torch, kind of a more definitive way to Misawa in some ways, because it's the last time he would hold the Triple Crown himself.
Yeah. This was, you know, Stanson. I keep calling him Stanson. You know, this is kind of the big culmination of it. Misawa had reached that point where he was able to, you know, to defeat Hansen and, you know, overcome, you know, perhaps that final obstacle, in All Japan, which then I think left him to deal with, you know, the rivalry with Kawada. There was the up and coming with Kobashi. You know, it was kind of the end of that era almost.
And then we move into June of 1995, specifically June 9th, when we see Misawa and Kobashi taking on Kawada and Taue for the World Tag Team titles. And this is one of the greatest tag team matches in the history of this company. It's one of the greatest tag team matches in the history of Japanese wrestling. It's one of the greatest tag team matches in the history of professional wrestling anywhere in the world. It's also one of the greatest matches in the history of professional wrestling anywhere in the world. It's a very significant match because it's the first time Kawada gets a pinfall over Misawa in the rivalry, as well as the first time Misawa himself had lost a pinfall to anyone since losing the belt to Steve Williams, a couple of years earlier. And so, you know, it's like now it's kind of the signal that it's Kawada's time to ascend and join Misawa. Like, he's just under Misawa, but he's not going to join Misawa on a similar level as him, as kind of maybe the co-ace of the company. That's the kind of feeling you get after watching this match, and if you've been following their rivalry for this entire time.
Yeah, I mean, it was always said, the dynamic in the Four Pillars was that for Kawada and Misawa, it was always the case that the Kawada felt never, you know, he felt inadequate to Misawa, and that he always had to catch up. He always had to overcome. He always had to prove himself against him. And you can really tell that in this match, you know, the pinfall, you know, the near pins, the fight between them, the vicious exchanges. It all is illuminated here. If you ever wanted to see, you know, just what things were like between them, the rivalry, the bitterness, you know, the fact that there was always this kind of, you know, difficulty between them because of that, this is a match that you want to watch if you want to see it illustrated.
Jumping to 1996, we see Misawa and Kobashi kind of break up their partnership, and Misawa would adopt Jun Akiyama as his new regular tag team partner. So now it's kind of like Misawa is even more of a, like, kind of like the senpai to Jin Akiyama's Kohai. And this is another one of my favorite tag teams. I love the team of Masao and Kawada, but I gotta say it's like Kobashi, Akiyama, Kawada, and Ogawa in terms of my personal rankings of his tag team partners. But this, they had just a wonderful dynamic, these two as a tag team.
Yeah, I mean, Akiyama, though he was obviously a different generation to them, you could never believe it. You'd always think that, you know, he'd joined All Japan at the same time as, you know, Misawa, Kobashi, you know, Kawada, Tawe, you know, even though they all joined at, you know, different times. You'd always thought from seeing him tag with Misawa that he'd been there from the start, and Akiyama hadn't, which is why they always called him. He was kind of like the fifth one of the four pillars.
I always thought of him as the unofficial fifth pillar as well when I first started watching his matches.
Yeah, Akiyama fitted in that well from day one. It was just a natural thing. You could never believe when you found out that Akiyama hadn't been there from day one. Looking at these matches, he just fitted in just so well.
And like he would fit in so well with Misawa that they would win the World Tag Team titles from Kawada and Tawe on May 23rd. And a day later, Misawa would lose the Triple Crown to Akira Tawe, who had won the 1996 Champions Carnival. So kind of a very busy and eventful weekend for Misawa. He would win one championship and lose the other one the next day.
Yeah. It was a strange time in All Japan because it was kind of going through an upheaval in a way, in the fact that, you know, Misawa, his dominance, it wasn't being diminished, but it was kind of being changed in a way, because there was a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? How am I going to describe it? Was being changed. He was kind of slipping into the Saruta role almost, in the fact that, you know, he was giving perhaps, you know, like Tawe a chance with the title, and here was Akiyama. So he was starting to, you know, enter that phase of his career.
Where he's kind of like, the old master that everyone has to knock off to reach that status as well. Yeah. It seems strange to say that in 96, because he's not that old and he's still like having really amazing matches. And I don't see. I'm not watching it in real time. I think it'd be different if I was watching it in real time, but, I'm watching it, and I'm watching a lot of this stuff out of order because I'm getting, I don't know which tapes to get, they're not in chronological order that I'm seeing this stuff in. Yeah. So, I'd be watching something from 1999, and then I'm jumping to 1995, and I'm like, what's the timeline of this? I'm not actually keeping track of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I can see if you're actually following the timeline of this, it's like I see what you're saying. Like he's now slowly but surely morphing into becoming his generation's Jumbo Tsuruta.
Yeah, because you heard, he's teaming with Ogawa, and Ogawa had a very late debut. He's teaming with Akiyama, who as we said has always seemingly been there. So he was kind of entering that phase.
So he closes out 1996 with teaming with Akiyama in the tag league, and they are defeated in the finals by Kawada and Tawe, with Kawada pinning Misawa in that match as well. So at least in tag matches, Kawada is having a lot of success against Misawa. January 20th, 1997, Misawa starts off 1997 really hot. He defeats Kenta Kobashi at the Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium to win his third Triple Crown Championship. And so at this point, like, Kobashi is really, kind of on that level with Kawada as Misawa's main rivals. Like, you can see that he has two main rivals, and not just like, him and Kawada. It's him, Kawada, and Kobashi. And then you have guys like Steve Williams lurking about. You have people like Tawe lurking about as well. And as well as, like, kind of Johnny Ace is kind of peeking in here and there in tag matches, mainly teaming with Kobashi. But it's really great because you see, like, Misawa having, matches with different kinds of opponents.
Yeah. Kind of like by this time, he, of course, himself was very much in control of a lot of what was going on in All Japan, which was, we'll get to, was creating a lot of problems backstage, because Baba by this time was starting to fade a little. And Misawa saw it, you know, as his chance, almost in a way, to bring in new things. So a lot was starting to change, at least, you know, perhaps not noticeably on the surface, but if you look, you can see the changes.
I think, you know, if you have the kind of like background information that you might have, Hisami, like, yeah, oh, I can see what's happening backstage based on the finish of this match, yeah, or the booking of this angle or this and that. Definitely. The Misawa would continue. Let's see, where am I in my notes? He would enter the 1997 Champion Carnival and reach the finals. It's a really interesting finals because this is like they do a thing where they have a three-way tie between Kobashi and Kawada and Misawa. And so what happens is that, you know, Misawa and Kobashi are going to wrestle first against each other. They go to a time limit draw. Kawada had defeated Misawa in singles competition right after, and he beats him. And this is the first time he pins him, but he pins him in 6 minutes and 9 seconds. So it's an interesting, you know, way to go about giving Kawada his first singles victory over Misawa, because it's kind of tainted, because he'd already wrestled 30 minutes earlier against Kobashi.
Yeah. There was a kind of a, and it's a sad thing to say, was that because obviously, you know, you had this rivalry between Misawa and Kawada, but sometimes it could spill over into, you know, perhaps petty little things like this. And it did always seem to me that it was, you know, it was kind of petty in a way. You know, I thought that perhaps, you know, it would have been perhaps better for, you know, Kawada just to have gone on for maybe a little longer than, you know, than just 6 minutes. Okay, it's a shock win. And, you know, things like that were starting to become in vogue in that kind of era. But still, there was some kind of malice to it.
Yeah, you would think that then that's your assumption that Misawa was booking the carnival then that particular match, not Baba. Yeah. Yes. Well, that would make sense, I suppose, if you really, you know, kind of become more aware of kind of like the real life, like bitter rivalry that these two would have backstage. Continuing on with 1997, we close off with, again, the 1997 Tag League. Misawa and Akiyama are in it. And they reach the finals, and they again face the team of Toshiaki Kawada and Akira Taue, and they lose against the Holy Demon Army. And at least in tag matches, you know, the HDA in Kawada is very successful against, you know, Misawa and whoever he's teaming with. We move into 1998, and January 26th is a very you know, important date. This is the debut of the Emerald Flosion that you know, Misawa uses to defeat Jun Akiyama.
Misawa had actually got the idea of a kind of an emerald waterfall, where you'd have, like, you know, the water which was of his weight, you know, of crashing down. I don't exactly know what exactly he was inspired by, but that was, you know, his inspiration for it, a kind of heavyweight waterfall.
Well, I mean, it's a very effective looking move. It's like, I wouldn't want to be the recipient of any of his moves, like, and that's definitely one of them that I'll take the regular tiger driver, thank you very much. Tiger suplex, no problem. Tiger driver, anyone? No. Emerald Flosion? No, thank you.
I think also by this time in All Japan, you had a very up-and-coming, you know, junior division. Marufuji had joined. You had, you know, very young Morishima, Kanemaru, Hashi, you know. So I think Misawa felt that he had himself to do something that was going to make him stand out against, you know, all these young guys. So I think it was a kind of a case of, well, I bought the elbow, I did the tiger driver, now this is the new move in town.
He was very, to me, he was like, him and Kobashi were the most innovative in coming up with new finishers during this period.
Kobashi, he wasn't as imaginative as Misawa was, because he never actually had a move for the burning hammer, a name even. It was just a move that he did, but he never actually named it. It was named by a computer game magazine, and the name stuck. Kobashi never actually named it himself.
Oh, maybe it's the video game I played.
It may well have been. Kobashi never knew where it came from. But whoever called it Burning Hammer, the name stuck. But it just wasn't Kobashi that named it.
It's an awesome name for a move, and it really fits that move too. So whoever created that name, very smart person.
And Kobashi, after that, you know, said that, you know, burning was not just a name; it was a way of life.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite factions is burning, both in Noah, and then later on with the team of, you know, Akiyama, Goshizaki, yeah, and, you know, Kotaro Suzuki, Atsushi Aoki, and Yoshinobu Kanemaru going to All Japan after they left all, you know, Noah. That's getting on a tangent. Yeah. One of my favorite periods, one of my favorite factions. Anyways, let's go to the 1998 Champion Carnival. Misawa is in it, but guess what? He has various neck and back injuries. He has a broken finger and a broken left kneecap. But despite this, and despite, you know, his doctor saying, you should get some surgery. You should take like about 6 weeks off. But so I was like, no, I'm going to enter the most grueling tag tournament in wrestling. You know, maybe the only thing close or maybe greater than that would be the G1 Climax over at New Japan. But still, being the Champion Carnival, doing all those matches, not fun. But he would reach the finals and he would win the Champion Carnival and he would do it against Akiyama, and obviously at this point it's like Akiyama is his Misawa. He's Jumbo.
Yeah.
Akiyama is him, yeah, right?
Akiyama is up and coming, and of course, you know, Misawa is now finding himself in the position where he's the veteran and he's now got all these young guys challenging him. Very sadly, in terms of, you know, injuries, again, you know, Misawa, you know, he was willing to put himself through that. Kobashi, you know, would put himself through, you know, similar things. But they never actually let their juniors do it. With them, they didn't want them to grow up, you know, how they had. So they actually took a lot more care over them when it came to things like that. But for themselves, with the way they've been trained, with the way they've been taught by Baba, you know, they destroyed themselves.
So from here, we move into May. Specifically May 1st, 1998, Giant Baba has booked the Tokyo Dome for a belated 25th anniversary show for All Japan Pro Wrestling. The main event of the show is Toshiaki Kawada challenging Mitsuhara Misawa for the Triple Crown. And this is the match where Misawa finally drops the championship to Kawada. Misawa went into the match. He had two blown knees, a bad neck, and a bad back. And he suffered a legitimate concussion during the match, because he could not remember the finish afterwards. Baba, you know, Baba is like changing his stance on, like, you know, showing weakness and letting people take time off. He announces that Misawa would take a break to heal. And then, you know, Misawa wouldn't come back to action until August 22nd of that year. But, you know, this is like where Misawa is like, yeah, would you say this is the greatest match in the rivalry between Misawa and Kawada?
Yeah, I don't think anything they ever had after that would ever have, you know, would have beaten this match. As I sometimes like to say, everything here just erupted. You know, all the frustration, all the rivalry, perhaps, you know, the relationship they had between them, just everything would just come out in this match. You know, the vicious elbows that, you know, Misawa threw, which have been called in this match, you know, some of the vicious, most, you know, some of the worst ever thrown in a wrestling match. But this was the pinnacle.
I would say so too. Like you get really that epic feel that this might be, you know, like there's so many great matches that involve Misawa in this time period, obviously, like against Jumbo, against, you know, Kobashi, Hansen, Taue, and Akiyama. But to me, like, this is kind of like, you know, if you want the apex of Misawa and you want the apex of Kawada and you want the apex of them against each other, this is the match you have to watch. Yeah.
It's far more than just, you know, two guys who don't like each other having a match. If you take into account all of the history behind it, and then it will take your breath away just what they accomplished in this.
So I mentioned that he comes back in late August to work the Summer Action Series 2 tour. You know, when asked, he's saying that, like, my knees are still bothering me. I only feel like about 60% healthy. But he felt he had to return because the two tours that he wasn't on had done terrible financially.
Yeah.
And they were two of the worst, you know, two worst tours in All Japan's history. This is kind of a problem that would plague him when he becomes the promoter and owner of Noah, because he can't, he feels he can't take time off because he hasn't made enough stars in the company, and business would fall without him, even though he needs to take time off. His his health is terrible. He's gained so much weight. And, you know, this is a contributing factor to obviously a topic we'll talk like later on at the end of the episode, which is his death. But this is kind of like, I guess, one of the first instances of him having this this pressure of like, I can't take time off. Like it's, I this company can't afford not to have me. It's not an ego thing. It's a matter of fact.
It was a fact. And the fact was that, you know, Misawa kind of wound up being a victim of his own celebrity. Just the fact that, you know, he was this popular and that I think he wound up paying the ultimate price for it.
You know, but at this time, he's also, he's gaining more influence in the back, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, so he's basically the booker of the company. And the only thing that Baba is still in charge of is Baba still books the Triple Crown programs and finishes. And he would do that through the end of the, of 98. But, you know, it's reported that, you know, Misawa was like, listen, I want to be the booker. It's my time. If you don't give it to me, I'm going to leave and form my own promotion. And you would think that most of the guys would leave with him.
Yeah, that was always a threat that I think Baba felt with Misawa, though he didn't really want to believe it. But he did know that, you know, that was, even if he didn't want to admit it to himself, that was always in the back of his mind. I don't think Misawa ever really kind of, you know, blackmailed into his face as if to say, you know, give him my own way or else. I think that everyone was aware of it, that, you know, if there was always this possibility, which we will see, was going to become reality.
Well, it would, you know, come true after Baba passes away. Yeah. I guess it might have been easier for Misawa to do it after Baba passed away than while Baba is still alive. Continuing on, though, in 1998 at the Budokan Hall, October 31st, Halloween, Misawa takes on Triple Crown champion Kenta Kobashi, and he would win the match to start his fourth Triple Crown. This match was rated Match of the Year by Tokyo Sports, Nippon Sports, and the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. It's one of the, one of my favorite matches of Misawa's. It's like, I think, a perfect culmination of like the rivalry of Kobashi and Misawa, like we talked about earlier with Kawada and Misawa at the Tokyo Dome. I thought this is like my favorite match between these two.
It's a completely different atmosphere from Kawada and Misawa, because you get that element of, you know, of bitterness, of hatred. With this one, it's more of a case of, you know, the younger pupil trying to overcome the older pupil. And you get that kind of feeling of a struggle between them, because Kobashi simply will not go down. Before this match, actually, Kobashi actually, because he knew what it was going to be like, they were going to, you know, they were going to beat the hell out of each other. He actually rang his mother and said to her, if anything ever happens to me in this match, he said, please do not blame Misawa, because he knew what it was going to be like, and what, you know, what potentially could happen if they pushed it that far.
Right. I mean, they take each other to the limit. But again, it's not filled with hate.
No, it's like with a different atmosphere, completely different atmosphere. It's, you know, it's not a case of, you know, Misawa winding Kawada up. But it's more of a case of Misawa pushing, you know, Kobashi, because he wants to see just how far Kobashi is going to go, you know, just how far, you know, just how much Kobashi is going to take. But Kobashi took it all. You know, he was not going to stay down no matter what. And there is a big what in that match.
Oh, yeah, definitely. At this time, Misawa's, you know, now teaming with Yoshinari Ogawa, a junior heavyweight in All Japan. But, like, it's you know, it's, I like this team. I thought they worked the most as a tag team, because I think Ogawa's such a great wrestler and such a student of wrestling. Yeah. Of like all kinds of wrestling, because you can see a lot of kind of Southern tag team, American Southern tag team influences on their tag team, a lot more double teams, coordinated attacks on with Ogawa as his partner. And you know, they would win the tag team titles a couple of times. They would enter their first tag league together in 98, but only placed fifth. But the we want to move into 1999, Hisami. We want to go to January 22nd, and here Misawa loses the Triple Crown to Kawada in his first defense of his fourth reign. But the problem here is that, you know, Kawada is very, like, kind of cursed with winning the Triple Crown because he has to vacate it the next day. And the reason why is because during the January 22nd, 1999 match, you know, Kawada Masada Wrestling, at some point, like, about maybe between seven and 10 minutes into the match, Kawada delivers a spinning back fist to the back of Masada's head with such force that he broke his right forearm and wrist.
Yes.
Yeah. But Kawada being the person that he is, and this being, you know, All Japan Pro Wrestling, he would continue to wrestle for another, oh, I don't know, 17 to 20 minutes with a broken arm.
Yep.
And the reason you see, like, Kawada debut a new move called the Gonzo Bomb it's a complete accident. Because he has a broken arm, he cannot get Masao up for a powerbomb. So he has him in this awkward position where he's just kind of draping between Kawada's, like, you know, like, Kawada's holding him, but he can't get him up, but he's got him between his, like, knees, sort of. And then he just drops to his knees and drives Masao's head straight into the mat. And I think, is it Inoue who freaks out when he sees this match? He's in the corner. One of the guys in the corner just like, oh!
Inoue kind of almost, well, if you watch him, you think he's going to just evaporate. No one could actually believe what they'd seen. And when things go like this in All Japan, it wasn't this match, but I think it was Misawa Kawada. Barbara was actually moved to tears. But they were so inventive. You're injured. They didn't stop the match. You just found ways around it.
You would never know that he broke his arm.
There was one match, and it was a Misawa Kawada title match, where Kawada had actually taken a load of suplexes in sequence from Misawa, and he'd actually passed out. And if you watch the footage, you can see Kawada's out. Misawa drags him to his feet. Kawada's got his eyes shut. He takes another suplex. Kyohei Wada was actually ready to throw in the towel, because he was actually screaming, you know, stop, because, you know, but they didn't. You just didn't do that. You kept on.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. Like, I have a passion for this era, for this style, but I recognize, like, you know, it is not something that people can do for a long time.
It will have lasting
effects that are so negative on your life.
And it did. And Kawada himself used to say during the series, he used to think, how long am I going to be able to keep this up? This is insane.
But it was reported that, you know, at the conclusion of this match, like, Giant Baba would say, this is the greatest match he had ever seen in his life. Yeah. And this was the last match that Giant Baba would see. Because 9 days later, he died of liver failure from complications of colon cancer. And this is where kind of the most tumultuous period of Mitsuharu Masawa's career, backstage at least, would occur. It's because now Motoko Baba has inherited her husband's shares of the company. And she wanted Mitsuo Momoda to become the president of All Japan, but, you know, Jumbo Tsuruta said, no, it has to be Misawa. He has earned it.
It was in Baba's will. Baba had actually left the presidency of All Japan to Misawa. So because it was her late husband's wishes, she couldn't actually contest it too much, but she could make things very, very difficult for Misawa. Baba knew that once he'd gone, there'd be nothing left, you know, there'll be nothing to stop them basically tearing into each other. And things got very, very petty between them. Misawa wanted a desk. People looked at him as if he was mad. He took over Barbara's old office and he put a few pictures and trophies up of his own. And he was told by Mrs. Baba not to, you know, destroy Barbara's presence there completely. And she even got at him for what he wore one time. He actually turned up at a meeting wearing, you know, obviously he was wearing a shirt, but I think it was, you know, kind of like a coloured shirt. And she told him very primly that from now on, if he was going to attend meetings, she expected him to wear a white shirt. And he said, well, I don't see what the problem was. Everyone else was wearing, you know, coloured shirts, stonewashed shirts, whatever. So things got very petty between them.
And this would culminate, we'll get to it in a couple of minutes, it would culminate in like the second Exodus that you referred to earlier. But just taking a very quick look at 1999, Misawa placed third in the Champion Carnival that year. He would defeat Vader, who had just joined All Japan from the WWF. He defeated Vader for the Triple Crown Championship on May 2nd, the main event of the Giant Baba Retirement Show. They didn't want to call it the Memorial Show. And this would be his fifth and final reign as the Triple Crown Champion. On May 7th, there's a press conference held to announce that Misawa was the new president of All Japan Pro Wrestling. 1 month later, on June 11th, Misawa successfully defends the Triple Crown against Kobashi at Budokan. This would win the Wrestling Observer Match of the Year award, and this would be the second time these two would win this award. You know, the interesting thing about this match is Kobashi suffered a broken nose, and Misawa was so fatigued that for the first time it said that reporters were not allowed to see him backstage.
No.
Just continuing on, Misawa successfully defends the title against Kawada on July 23rd, defeating him with the dreaded Tiger Driver 91. Misawa and Ogawa continue their winning ways as a tag team. They win both the All Asia and World Tag Team titles from the team of No Fear, which was Yoshihiro Takayama and Takao Omori on August 25th. And the interesting thing about that tag match, Asami, is that they won that match. They wanted that match against No Fear because No Fear had kind of monopolized the tag team titles, both the All-Asia tag titles and the World Tag Team titles. And they just wanted to, you know, get those both of those off of them. So they vacated the All-Asia tag team titles, and Misawa booked a tournament to fill those titles. But they kept the World Tag Team titles for themselves.
Yeah, by this time, obviously, you know, Misawa was, you know, was the president of the company. He was the booker. So he could pretty much do what he wanted, really, obviously within reason. But things were difficult at this stage.
Misawa and Ogawa would lose those tag team titles to the team of Akiyama and Kobashi, burning, great tag team name, on October 23rd in Nagoya. And then finally, you know, again, like it seems like a pattern, like Misawa gets the tag team titles and then soon after he loses the Triple Crown, because on October 30th, his fifth and final Triple Crown title reign would be ended by the man he won the title off of, and that would be Vader. And then closing out 1999, the WSTDL, Misawa and Ogawa achieved third place in the tag league, and we get to the end of Misawa's All Japan career, February 7th, 2000. Misawa was pinned by Jun Akiyama for the first time in singles competition during the same main event of that show. And that's one of my favorite Jun Akiyama matches of all time.
Yeah, this was kind of, I think if AP'd allowed to, you know, if things had been different and he continued on in All Japan, I think we would probably have seen the rise of Akiyama in the way that Misawa had done. I think that Misawa probably would have started taking perhaps maybe a bit more, you know, of a backseat, you know, done, you know, perhaps a bit more of the Saruta thing, you know, dealt with backstage issues, managed the company, overseen it. And I think we would have seen the rise of Akiyama. But obviously things didn't plan out quite that way.
No, I tend to think that based on, like, you know, the TV I watched from then, is that, you know, like his like new four pillars would have been like Akiyama, Mossman, Takayama, and Omori. That's the feeling I get, because they were pushed the heaviest to be, and like Akiyama and Manuike and Mossman were kind of tag team partners. And I felt they would probably have gotten the tag team titles if the Exodus didn't happen.
Yeah.
And No Fear was like eventually going to break up. They were kind of like positioned as like the new Holy Demon Army.
Yeah, they were going to be kind of like the, you know, this was the late 90s, early 2000s. So they were going to be kind of like more of like the heels, more of like, you know, the bad boys in town. I think that was the route they were going to go with them. And they did also as well kind of allude to that early on in Noah as well.
Yeah, definitely. You can kind of see it in the booking, but we'll never know for sure because obviously, you know, like later on, Misawa leaves.
Yeah.
Just to finish things off with his in-ring career in All Japan, he entered the 2000 Champion Carnival And he changed this format from Rod Robin to single elimination tournament. This was the first time this format had been used for the Champion Carnival since 1974. But this you know, this tournament was won by reigning Triple Crown champion Kenta Kobashi. You know, he defeated Masao in the semifinals, and then he went on to finally win his first, you know, Champion Carnival, and yeah. I guess only Champion Carnival after yeah. 10 consecutive appearances.
Yeah, and then everything blew up and Kobashi left. But Kobashi himself yeah. couldn't believe it. You know, he said that he'd won this tournament, and then a few months later he had to vacate the title.
So let's go into the exodus. We'll wrap things up with this part. So we've kind of been touching upon the rivalry backstage between Motoko Baba and Misawa. What do you think was the straw that broke the camel's back for both of them?
Well, I think the straw that obviously when Baba died, the floodgates opened and there was nothing now to stop her and him from, you know, attacking each other. But I think the straw that broke the camel's back was the fact that the humiliation of her having him removed by a majority vote as the company president. Takayama said that he knew that something was up, even, you know, perhaps a few days before that, because I think Misawa probably did have an inkling of what was going to happen. Because Misawa had actually gone and he'd asked people, if I leave, would you come with me? I'm going to start a new promotion. I'd like you to be on board. He actually mentioned it to Takayama over dinner. But Takayama said that he actually knew that something was up because Misawa had been going around, you know, he'd been walking up and down the bus, he'd been talking to people, he'd been acting furtively, I think was the best way to put it. Takashi Sugiura said that Misawa actually approached him personally about it. Marufuji said that, you know, he never told him, he was just expected to go with his teacher, which he would have had. But I think the straw was just the final humiliation of, you know, Barbara's will being overturned and being basically, you know, thrown out of the company and being at someone else's mercy.
So my question for you is, you know, at this point, you know, Motoko inherits the, you know, 85% of All Japan's shares.
Yeah.
And Nippon TV holds the other 15. So yeah. She has controlling interest of the company. Do you think that if Misawa was able to gain control of the majority of his shares in the company, and then he would have all the, you know, the clout in the company, do you think he would have stayed with All Japan? Like, if he could phase out Motoko Baba completely out of the company, just give her like a stipend or something like that, and so she's still connected and Baba's widow is taken care of, but he had full control of the company financially and politically. Do you think he would have stayed, or do you think he still would want to form his own legacy with Noah?
No, I think he would have stayed because, as Motoko put it, Baba, you know, who is, you know, as she put it, is, you know, Misawa, whose father loved him. She meant Baba. I think he would have stayed at All Japan, and I think he would have stayed true to, you know, Baba's memory and Baba's will. But it got to a point where he just couldn't stay. But I do think that he would have stayed with All Japan had things been different, or, you know, had he had controlling share in the company, which meant that she couldn't touch him, he would have stayed.
I mean, I look at that. If things were different, he had complete control of All Japan, that what we saw would happen with Noah, in like how, you know, the amazing, you know, especially with the juniors, like it would have been awesome to see New Japan finally have a junior scene that would have rivaled New Japan's.
Yeah.
And these emerging stars, like, he was in, like, I think if he was able to keep Kawada on his side, if he could have stayed with All Japan, or if he could have taken Kawada to Noah, I think that would have helped things out tremendously, because honestly, if you look at Kawada's career post Exodus, he gets in the best shape of his career, and he has some injuries he has to deal with, but he's in pretty good shape, like, physically compared to the other three.
He
takes care of himself really well, and he has like some amazing run. He has an amazing run with the Triple Crown himself post Exodus, but you know, that is what it is. And then let's go on to, like, he forms Pro Wrestling Noah, and like, just give me, like, you know, your 3-minute synopsis of, like, what you think was you know, successful about, because it was a very successful company for a period of time.
It was. Basically, what happened was that Misawa left All Japan and he formed NOAH. And NOAH was to be an offshoot of what he couldn't do with All Japan, and it combined the teaching of the new trainees with the philosophy and the ideals of Baba, which is something that still remains to this day. It's called, you know, Misawa style, stroke, you know, brackets, parentheses, whatever, Baba style. The company was obviously based on what was remaining of the four pillars, Misawa in the lead, Kobashi, Akiyama, and obviously, you know, you had Takayama in the old days. But the problem was that while this was all well and good for about 2000 till 2009, what happened was that while their junior division thrived, their juniors were not going to remain juniors forever, and some of them became heavyweights. What very sadly I keep saying was that Misawa actually never actually ever took on board was something that his own seniors did for him, was to perhaps to step aside and try and create new stars. So what they found themselves in the position was that Misawa was the star. He couldn't retire. You know, he was perhaps thinking about it at the time of his death, but things just got worse and worse. You know, the Japanese economy took a dive. MMA was starting to become popular. You know, and all sorts of different things happened. And they hadn't actually created anything, you know, there was no new heavyweights, there was no new blood, apart from perhaps, you know, Takeshi Rikyo's, you know, run with the GHC that was being infused into it. Okay, you know, he gave it to Marufuji, but what should have happened was that Marufuji should have overcome Misawa, except when their match came, Misawa took the belt back. So it came to the point where after Misawa died that NOAH, in a very telling quote by Marufuji, was that we've lived too long on the credit of our seniors and now there's nothing left. And it has been a huge lesson that NOAH have learnt from, because they've created new younger stars with the veterans still there, not to feel threatened by them, but to kind of usher them along. So what Misawa's legacy has been to NOAH, I think, is one of, you know, one of inspiration, but I think also one of a warning, you know, be inspired by what he did, but, you know, but learn your lesson by the fact that, you know, what he didn't do.
Right. I totally agree with you. Like, watching NOAH in real time in the early 2000s, I'm like, oh my God, you got Marufuji, you got Kenta.
Yeah.
They just need to put on some weight. They have the personality for it.
Yeah.
You have... And not Rikyo, I never saw anything in Rikyo, but you had Takayama, who's becoming a big star in MMA. Hopefully I could cross over.
Morishima.
That's the thing. You had Morishima. And I think if they pulled the trigger on Morishima a little earlier, you could have got a lot more mileage out of the guy before, like, his health problems led to his personal problems. And he's out of wrestling now. But, like, and you could have had, like, you know, some prime years out of Kenta as a heavyweight and Marufuji as a heavyweight before injuries caught up with those guys and before Kenta goes to an ill-fated run with the WWE. But it is what it is. And let's end off on a sad note. Unfortunately, we have to talk about Misawa's tragic death on June 13th, 2009. He's teaming with Go Shiozaki. They're challenging the GHC Tag Team Champions at the time, Akitoshi Saito and Bison Smith. And it's in this match that Misawa takes the back suplex from Saito, one of Saito's signature moves. But, you know, Misawa, for whatever reason, takes this move, a move that he'd taken many times from different people throughout his career.
Yeah.
He takes it the wrong way, and it causes an injury to him that's basically the cervical cord is a cervical cord transection. So his first and second cervical vertebrae are severed.
Yeah. He actually had it's thought that he also suffered a heart attack as well, which would be borne out by the fact that his face was turning blue as well. And he whispered, "There's something wrong, stop the match." And those are his last words. The referee tried to do CPR, but it didn't work. And, you know, when the paramedics arrived, Misawa was sweating so much, the arena was so hot, that everyone took off their t-shirts and they gave it to the paramedics to wipe the sweat away with. But it was too late. There was nothing that could be done. By that time, Misawa was in a terrible physical shape. He had a high level of, I mean, I know there's this, you know, people saying, there is this rumor where people say, oh, well, you know, he didn't, you know, rely on any kind of medication. He relied solely on, you know, acupuncture. That's not true. He was actually on a high level of painkillers. His physical condition by that time had ballooned. He didn't have, you know, the shape that he had in all Japan. And after he died, it was said that they'd found home diet kits, you know, stuff that he'd mail ordered in his office, simply because he was in too much pain. He wasn't sleeping. He was drinking heavily. You know, he had to attend to being both an active wrestler, being in, you know, in the league, and also, you know, and running Noah. But one of the kind of things that Misawa did do for his juniors was to insist that when they were injured, that they take time off. There was no shame in going to the hospital. There was no shame in being injured. There was no shame in being operated on. He didn't want them to end up, you know, as he did, basically destroying himself.
Yeah, you kind of wish, like, maybe he would take his own advice in that regard as well.
The tragic thing was that around about the time when Misawa died was that he was actually starting to, you know, realize that if he built up Shiozaki, then, you know, obviously he'd throw into the mix Marufuji, he had Kenta. There was this whole junior scene, which then, you know, this whole, you know, junior heavyweight, you know, by that I mean younger heavyweight scene, which he was actually starting to realize that perhaps, you know, he could now build up. They could leave Noah, and he could now retire and attend to the things that he wanted to, but very sadly, it was just too late.
Yes, unfortunately, it's a tragic end to one of the, you know, one of the greatest in-ring performers of all time. I learned something from, like, I think it was your appearance on Eastern Lariat, or it was something you wrote on your blog, but like he had left a letter behind for
he did
or if he in the case of he if he died in the ring.
He did. He had a premonition that this is how it was gonna end. He was gonna die in the ring. So he wrote a letter, and he entrusted it to one of his close friends, basically saying to the wrestler who he lost his life against, you know, it's not your fault. I want you to continue. You know, I'm not angry with you. Akitoshi Saito, who sadly was the one that it happened to, whenever he's wrestled, whatever arena he's in, whatever show he's on, he has always kept that letter with him. He's always kept. He won't enter any kind of match, any kind of arena without it.
It's a, you know, really selfless act, in, you know, like for him to do in, you know, with in the event that he thought he was going to die in the ring, and then he wanted to make sure that the person he was in the ring with didn't blame themselves for it.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, let's wrap things up. I'm going to do a quick accounting of his title history. So starting with All Japan Pro Wrestling, he won the All Asia Tag Team Championship twice, once with Kenta Kobashi, once with Yoshinari Egawa. He was a Triple Crown champion five times. He was the World Tag Team Champion six times, with Toshiaki Kawada, Kenta Kobashi, Jun Akiyama, and Yoshinari Ogawa. He was the NWA International Junior Heavyweight Champion one time as Tiger Mask. He was the PWF World Tag Team Champion one time with Jumbo Tsuruta as Tiger Mask. He had won the Champion Carnival twice in 1995 and 1998. He had won the Tag League four times in 1992, 1993, 1994, and 1995, once with Toshiaki Kawada, and the remaining three times with Kenta Kobashi. In Pro Wrestling Noah, he was the GHC Heavyweight Championship champion three times. He was the tag team champions twice, both with Yoshinari Egawa, and he won the Global Tag League one time in 2009 with Go Shiozaki. And the awards he had won from different publications are too numerous to mention. Just go check out, like, your work, Hisami. I'm sure you have a list of it. Check out his Wikipedia. Check out, like, you know, different articles out there. I do recommend like Dave Meltzer's obituary on Misawa in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. It's a really interesting, fascinating read, really in-depth as well. But yeah, Hisami, any final notes on Misawa before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to say that I think Misawa's life is both an inspiration and it's a warning. It's an inspiration as to what you can achieve, no matter what background, you know, you come from, no matter your start in life. But I think it's also a warning, to perhaps, you know, learn, you know, perhaps the lessons that, you know, that people gave to you, you know, what other people have done for you, to do it to others. And also perhaps the fact that in the end, you know, at the end, you know, you can give as much as you want for something, but your life, you shouldn't have to give. So I think his tale is both an inspiration and it's a warning.
Definitely. And with those words, let's wrap it up here. Hisami, thank you so much for joining me here on the Long and Winding Royal Road, talking about the great Mitsuhara Misawa. I learned so much. I did a lot of research for this, but I learned so much just listening to you talk about him again. And where can people find more of your work? They want to, if they were inspired by, my God, like I need to learn more about Noah and Misawa and, you know, Kobashi and all of them.
If it's Noah you want, then you can follow my Twitter. I'm on HI5AME. But if it's you're interested in Misawa's All Japan era, and this also includes the history of Barbara as well, then the best place for you to follow me would be on one of my sub-Twitter accounts. And this one is dedicated to the four pillars, Misawa, Tawe, Kobashi, Kawada. You can find this one at, let me just bring it up, it's the Four Pillars of Wrestling, and it's the Four Pillars One. And this is basically history, tidbits, you know, stories about the Four Pillars and about Baba. I am perhaps thinking of creating one for Riki Dozan as well, because, you know, that's started to interest me, this whole history and background of Pure, which I think gets forgotten and gets lost. But yep, those are my two accounts where you can find out more about Noah or more about the Four Pillars and Baba as well.
Wait, that's your account? That's your other account?
Yep.
I didn't know this.
Four Pillars of Wrestling, Four Pillars One is me.
I love that account. So I love both your accounts, Noah one and your Four Pillars.
Thank you.
See, I learn everything. I learn things even at the end of this podcast. But Sami, again, thank you very much. Please check her out on Twitter. Check her blog out as well. On behalf of Sami, I want to thank all the listeners for sticking with us. It's been like almost 2 hours we talked about Misawa. I hope people learned a lot. I know I did. I learned a lot of new things. And until next time, I will say on behalf of Sami, goodbye until the next episode.